Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Now I'd like to introduce the next speaker, a very special person, Mr. Herman Shaw, one of our honored guests and a participant in a Tuskegee syphilis study. Mr. Shaw was an original participant in the study, and he participated for 40 years. He was married to Fannie Mae Greathouse for 62 years. They have two children, both college graduates. He has six grandchildren and one great-grandchild. And he told me last night that for the last 52 years, he has been driving his tractor, and he already has his garden in place for this year. Welcome, Mr. Herman Shaw.
Thank you very, very much. On behalf of all the survivors who have today and those who could not attend, and on behalf of their heirs, my fellow participants who have died, I wish to thank Mr. President Clinton, thank you very much, for inviting us to the White House. It has been over 65 years since we entered the program. We are delighted today to close this very tragic and painful chapter in our lives. We were treated unfairly, to some extent, like guinea pigs. We were not pigs. We were not dancing boys. We were projected in the movie on Miss Evers' Boys. We were all hard-working men and not boys, and citizens of the United States. The wounds that were inflicted upon us cannot be undone. I'm saddened today to think of those who did not survive and whose families will forever live with the knowledge that their death and suffering was preventable.
Context of White Supremacy, Gust here, Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, May 27th, 2016. So I have been told. You were able to hear that was Mr. Herman Shaw, one of the victims of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. He was a part of a presentation with former President Slick Willie Bill Clinton when they were doing their formal apology for the terrorism that was wreaked on these black citizens of Alabama. You can see that entire presentation at C-SPAN. They actually have quite a bit of footage dealing with what happened at Tuskegee, including the author of our book, Harriet A. Washington. We will go ahead and get right to it. This is study session number 6, Medical Apartheid, Harriet A. Washington. Phenomenal book this week. We will be halfway to the finish line. Halfway to the finish line. We're picking up in chapter 7, where we are still dealing with the horrors of Tuskegee, context of white supremacy, medical apartheid, Harriet A. Washington, audio segment number 1.
A magic bullet withheld. Imagine the global jubilation that would greet the announcement of a simple injection to cure AIDS. This kind of exuberance accompanied the discovery of penicillin, a magic bullet, with which scientists believe they would finally tame syphilis, a plague with which medicine had wrestled for centuries. In 1943, the PHS's network of clinics triumphantly dispensed penicillin nationally, to the deep satisfaction of Surgeon General Thomas Perrin, who had adopted syphilis eradication as a personal and professional crusade. In his 1937 book, Shadow on the Land, Perrin had bemoaned the high rates of syphilis in black and poor populations, and now he could lay claim to having orchestrated its demise. But even Perrin, when presented with this antibiotic holy grail, opted for continued experimentation with the black men of Macon County. He explained that the availability of penicillin meant the opportunity represented by the Tuskegee Syphilis Study's pool of syphilitic patients would never come again and must be exploited. 33 years after the study began, social changes eclipsed the moral question posed by penicillin, a question that the PHS had dismissed so blithely. The nation that had passively accepted medical apartheid and sharecropper slavery in 1932 was racked by constant ethnic tension and racial warfare by the 1960s. Deadly racial repression with dogs, guns, lynchings, and bombings reigned in the defiant South. And in the North, murderous street brawls erupted over voting rights, school desegregation, de facto segregation, and conflicts with police. National Guard troops enforced integration as urban riots consumed northern and southern cities alike in blood and fire. But these events were tangential to the shabby, tightly circumscribed lives of the weary, destitute sharecroppers in the rural study, whose median age was now 74. They were enfeebled beyond their years by poverty, prostrating labor, and syphilis, and the PHS physicians were deeply concerned because three men had already been lost to autopsy when they died without the researchers learning of it in time to obtain their bodies. In order to assure the needed autopsies, it was essential for the PHS to track closely the aged men's serious illnesses and hospitalizations, any one of which could end in death. However, Eunice Rivers was aging too, and becoming too old to track them. She was given the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare's highest honor, the Ovida Culp Hobby Award, for 25 years during which, through selfless devotion and skillful human relations, she has sustained the interest and cooperation of the subjects of a venereal disease control program in Macon County, Alabama, then retired. The black nurse who replaced her was told to be sure to visit any seriously ill or hospitalized man frequently. Suddenly, in 1965, the nation's civil rights drama played out in the medical sphere as the PHS found its ethics assailed from many directions. The radical leftist group, Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, discovered the Tuskegee Syphilis Study and held rallies urging that it be ended. But they were easily dismissed as a fringe group given to counterculture hyperbole. However, the question of racism in the study also surfaced within the medical fold, as Alan Brandt discovered when he found the minutes of a 1965 meeting at the Centers for Disease Control, CDC. An excerpt is illuminating. Racial issue was mentioned briefly. Will not affect the study. Any questions can be handled by saying that these people were at the point that therapy would no longer help them. They are getting better medical care than they would under any other circumstances. The same year, a white physician, Dr. Irwin J. Schatz of the Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, wrote the PHS after reading a medical paper on the Tuskegee Syphilis Study in the Archives of Internal Medicine. His letter began, "I am utterly astounded by the fact that physicians allow patients with potentially fatal disease to remain untreated when effective therapy is available." His letter was never answered. By the year's end, the study was dealt what would eventually prove a fatal blow by Peter Buxton, a young Polish immigrant who worked as a venereal disease interviewer for the PHS. He learned of the study and immediately risked his job by writing his superiors to ask that it be stopped. A handful of PHS physicians responded by holding meetings, at which they lectured Buxton on the scientific merits of their work and decided to continue the study. In 1967, Buxton left the agency to attend law school, but he occasionally wrote the PHS to renew his complaints, to no avail. By 1969, physical examinations and autopsies revealed that as many as 100 of the men had died of syphilis and its complications, and others had died of heart disease that researchers ascribed to syphilis. In 1972, Buxton, exasperated by 7 years of PHS inaction, told a journalist friend about the study. On July 25th of that year, Gene Heller broke the story for the Associated Press. Shocked PHS officials denied any knowledge of human rights abuses. However, they also deftly defended their work by explaining how the syphilis treatment available in 1933, arsphenamine, would have been worthless and possibly too dangerous to give the men. They added that treating the men now would risk their health. None of these claims was true. Arsphenamine had been the standard of care when the study began, and treating the men now would imperil only the study's data. The news media, physicians, politicians, and ordinary citizenry, black and white, expressed horrified anger and demanded an explanation from the government and some sort of assurance that such cruelty would never again be sanctioned by the PHS. The government promised to conduct an internal review. But when it became evident that this would neither mollify the press nor appease public outrage, Senator Ted Kennedy held hearings, and a Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, HEW, official, Assistant Secretary for Health and Scientific Affairs, Merlin K. Duvall, M.D., announced an investigation on August 24, 1972. Duvall appointed a 9-member panel of esteemed professionals whose dissection of the study quickly degenerated into inefficiency, shouting matches, political infighting, accusations of a government cover-up, and the appalling destruction of key evidence, a grimly self-destructive brawl that has never before been made public. Cover-up. The ad hoc panel. Because the government-appointed ad hoc panel to the Tuskegee syphilis study did indeed end the study and also provided the impetus for important new laws that still regulate U.S. human medical experimentation, it is widely assumed to have done its job. But interviews I conducted with its surviving members suggest that the ad hoc panel also suffered miserable failures. The group of academic, political, and economic leaders was chaired by Dillard University President Broadus Butler, Ph.D., an illustrious educator and Tuskegee Airman. The other members included J. Katz, M.D., a Yale University psychiatrist and professor of law, Ron Brown, the general counsel of the National Urban League and future U.S. Secretary of Commerce, and Vernal Cave, M.D., the director of the Bureau of Venereal Disease Control for the New York City Health Department. After sanctioning the most lengthy instance of experimental abuse in Western history, Secretary Duvall petulantly cast himself in the role of masochistic victim, declaring, "I wanted a panel that would be sympathetic to the public point of view rather than to the scientific or factual point of view, so I loaded it with angry blacks. That way there could be no criticism." The panel was not loaded with blacks. 5 members were black, including Chairman Butler, Vernal Cave, and Ron Brown, and 4 were white, including J. Katz. Although nearly all the panel members expressed deep anger as they learned details of the study, they were also seasoned thinkers, familiar with ethics, medical issues, or both. Because the black panelists included physicians, scientists, lawyers, and a university president, they presumably were able to grasp the scientific point of view. But the panel had no historian. The panelists' clamor for the truth was muted by the narrowness of the charge Duvall gave them. The committee was to determine whether the study was justified in 1932 and whether it should have been continued when penicillin became available, to recommend whether the study should be continued at this point in time, and if not, how it should be terminated in a way consistent with the rights and health needs of its remaining participants, and finally, to determine whether existing policies to protect the rights of patients participating in health research conducted or supported by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare are adequate and effective, and to recommend improvements in these policies if needed. The second charge was the easiest. The panelists decided that the study should be terminated immediately and that the men and their families should be given medical care and compensatory funds. On the first charge, the panel determined that the study was ethically unjustified, both when it was initiated and after the discovery that penicillin was a safe and effective treatment that might have saved the lives and health of the subjects. On the third charge, the panel determined that there were inadequate provisions regarding the protection of human subjects of research. It mandated that a formal department be instituted for regulation of human subjects research, a National Human Subjects Investigation Board. However, the panel's charge excluded some of the most important ethical questions, skirting the critical issue of the initial 1932 decision to withhold treatment in the form of bismuth and therapeutic dosages of arsphenamine even before penicillin became available. These were imperfect medications, but they were the standard of care in the 1930s. Panel member Fred Speaker, a lawyer, complained, "I thought at the beginning that they were asked to do something by these people that was inappropriate. The scope we were given was too limited." The panel also had far too little time, just 12 meetings over 7 months, to analyze a 40-year experiment. "We asked for an extension," says Katz, "and they begrudgingly gave us 3 additional months. Many of us felt that it was impossible to complete the work in that time. When we asked for another extension, it was denied." The committee's report determined that the men may have submitted voluntarily, but that this did not constitute informed consent. However, the panel addressed the wrong ethical question. The pertinent issue was not whether the men had been duly informed of the experiment's danger, but that the men had never been informed that they were in an experiment at all. They thought they were only receiving treatment. Yet the committee seemed not to understand this. Why? Because there was no historian on the panel. It was hampered in discerning and interpreting the veins of truth trickling through the heaps of documents the government provided and in seeking out other crucial information. Yet, despite Duvall's claim that he had selected angry blacks, the report did not condemn the racist mentality that informed the study. Why not? Some members pointed to panel chairperson Dr. Broadus Butler, insisting that he had been charged with engineering a government whitewash, and this suspicion generated friction from the very first meeting. In 1994, Dr. Vernal Cave said, he, Butler, spent the whole meeting telling us how important it was to keep an open mind, to look at the facts and not to jump to conclusions. He said how important it was not to have an opinion until all the information was in. As a result, most of the meeting was spent on that, getting lectured. No one else had anything to say. Then it turned out that he was the only one that came there with a closed mind. Dr. Katz agrees. "I believe that, for whatever reason, Butler was beholden to HEW at the time. I don't know what his relationship was with them prior to his appointment as chair. He insisted that our charge was more limited than the interpretations some of us gave to our mission. He constantly slowed us down and forced us to go through maneuvers to get him to do certain things he thought were beyond the mandate given to us." Fred Speaker adds, "As things developed, I just felt that we couldn't just let it go on. Butler, I think, wanted to keep things status quo. He was not the kind of guy to make demands on the administration or to say things that would embarrass the administration. For example," Speaker recalls, "at some point, we learned that although we had given instructions to stop the experiment, HEW had not done anything yet, and the experiment was still being conducted. That's when we had our mini-revolt. What I remember saying is, "Stop fucking around! Let's do something!" Butler had a serious discussion with future U.S. Commerce Secretary Brown, who was very forceful. Ron Brown was a hell of a guy. He deserves a great deal of credit. I'm sure the four of us on the committee forced HEW to stop it immediately. Katz adds, "By October or November, it became clear that we had to challenge the chairman as a group and not accept how he wanted to proceed. An alliance formed between me and Vernal Cave, and we were quickly joined by Fred Speaker and by a Princeton theologian, Dr. Seward Hiltner, who had knowledge about the problems of human experimentation. Ron Brown was chair of the Urban League. He was involved in national affairs and reluctant to get involved in what would soon become a controversial study. He was concerned about how it would affect his future position in government, but he was on our side. We could count on him." Not everyone blames Dr. Butler for the group's failures. One panel member, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said, "I think that there was a great deal of guilt and frustration about the members' inability to do what they felt they were there to do." To some extent, Dr. Butler became a focus for that frustration. Another panel member, the late Dr. Jean Louise Harris, denied perceiving any friction between Dr. Butler and his colleagues until the final report was submitted, when we all became very angry. In the end, the panel wrote a strongly worded report that was critical of the government and the PHS. However, all the interviewed panel members agree that Butler refused to sign it or even to chair the meeting at which it was discussed. The surviving panelists say they felt it critically important to present a unanimous report. So they argued long and bitterly until, at Butler's urging, they adopted a softer version whose language was less critical. Among other changes, the less confrontational new version deleted references to intentional racism and removed complaints that the panelists were afforded insufficient time and resources to thoroughly investigate the study's issues. When the panelists received their copies of the final report in the mail, however, they were stunned by its cover letter, which read, "The final report of the Tuskegee Syphilis Study Ad Hoc Advisory Board is transmitted herewith. The chairman specifically abstains from concurrence in this final report, but recognizes his responsibility to submit it." Butler had induced them to water down the report, they say, then distanced himself from it. In late December 1995, Dr. Butler agreed to discuss the ad hoc panel with me. But, tragically, he fell ill shortly thereafter and died before we could do so. He almost certainly would have given a very different account of his role and of the group's dynamics, and his passing leaves a vacuum in the story that no one else can fill. Conspiracy theory. Duvall spoke of censure at the hands of angry blacks, but perhaps he should have worried about angry doctors instead. Most of the panelists believed that the government had hobbled their panel to preclude any real expression of outrage. However, the most painful revelation was yet to come. After the panel issued its report, Alan Brandt, who was then still a Columbia University graduate student, tracked down boxes of documents in the National Archives that fleshed out the full history and rationale of the Tuskegee Syphilis Study. Upon reading these, he realized that the panel had completely misunderstood the study's nature. He then wrote a paper, clearly tracing the study's history and criticizing the panel for having failed to obtain the historical information necessary to judge the study for what it was: experimental exploitation of the unwitting. Brandt's work made it painfully clear, says Katz, that the panel had been sabotaged by the government staff they relied upon for information. "It was the first time I had heard about them, the documents. We had asked the staff repeatedly to find these documents, and they always came up empty-handed. Alan discovered the documents in the National Archives. I felt very foolish, and I'm sure my fellow committee members felt foolish for not having known about the National Archives repository for documents of this kind. My speculation is that several staff members must have known about the National Archives and should have looked there. They, HEW, minimized what emerged later, particularly the deceptive aspects of the study. I wrote a letter of complaint to Senator Kennedy and said I thought there was a cover-up. I urged him to investigate. Kennedy's office determined that there had been no cover-up, but Katz disagreed, and he was determined to enlist the panelists' help in demanding that the government admit how it had sabotaged their investigation. He says that, with the exception of Vern, Cave, I didn't get a response from anyone. All of them had guilt feelings, including myself, that we hadn't done enough. I felt guilty that I let academic work and family life and other considerations influence me to do less. The remorse may be appropriate, but so much was arrayed against the panel. The tangential charges, the failure to include a historian in the investigation of medical abuse that spanned four decades, the likely withholding of key documents, the impossibly short time frame, and possibly the manipulations of government sympathizers, all ensured that truth would be the first casualty of the Tuskegee syphilis study investigation. However, the panel engaged in a cover-up of its own. Cave recalled, "We went there, to Tuskegee. We interviewed the victims, Nurse Rivers, the sociologists, everyone. We had them all on tape. When we got back at the next meeting, Broadus Butler said, the first item on the agenda is whether we should keep the tape. I was amazed. The others were amazed, and we spent the whole session talking about the tape. I'm going to confess that during that session, I thought of the fact that Nurse Rivers was an innocent person in this whole thing. In a moment of weakness, I said to myself, it would be a shame to have this woman put in court, put on the stand, pilloried. She was an innocent victim. So I went along with destroying the tape. It was a terrible thing, Katz sadly muses. He, the chair, Dr. Broadus Butler, made the recommendation. He said it was to protect Rivers, and I unfortunately went along with it. I wish we hadn't done so. I wish I had been more alert to make the tape under seal, not to destroy it. We hadn't done our job well. The group burned the tape, and with it were lost first-person accounts from scientists and staffers who are now dead. Moreover, in trying to protect the reputation of Eunice Rivers, the panel may have damned it by robbing her of her voice. This was a shocking act for which I have found no parallel in contemporary committees, and had there been a historian on the panel, it would not have taken place. After the panel's recommendation ended the study in 1972, its participants and their families began to receive medical treatment. Macon County Attorney Fred Gray filed a $1.8 billion class action civil lawsuit on July 23, 1973, which named as defendants HEW, the PHS, the CDC, the State of Alabama, and the Milbank Fund, as well as several individual PHS officers and a few John Does to cover any unknown malefactors. The suit resulted in a 1974 out-of-court settlement for more than $10 million. It yielded a mere $37,500 for each living study participant, $15,000 for his heirs, and nearly $1 million in legal fees for Gray, which was deducted from the payments made to the men. The living control group members received even less. Black antiheroes in white. The Tuskegee syphilis study compromised the reputations not only of white, but also of many black caregivers, by alerting the nation to the possibility that they were directly responsible for this notorious medical abuse of black patients. But the roles of some key African Americans in the study have been exaggerated. In 1995, Dr. Henry Foster's nomination as Surgeon General was derailed by accusations, which he denies, that he attended a meeting where the Tuskegee syphilis study was discussed, and the resultant media uproar castigated Foster for failing to denounce or to end the study. Foster denied knowing anything about the study before the news media exposed it in 1972. Even though no one could demonstrate that he had been present, the very accusation was enough to end his hopes for appointment. By contrast, no news accounts have censured or even identified the scores of white AMA members at a 1965 meeting where the Tuskegee syphilis study was reported upon in great detail. For that matter, the PHS physicians responsible for the study have never been charged or punished. Eunice Rivers, a modestly educated black nurse in the profoundly segregated rural Alabama of the 1940s, occupied the lowest rung in the medical hierarchy. Hers was an era when a nurse was a handmaiden trained to assist, not to question, the physician, and a black nurse occupied an even lower professional stratum than a white one. Yet Rivers came to shoulder the burden of America's most infamous instance of medical research abuse. She has been accused of retaining men in an experiment that she knew could only harm them. But all her spontaneous statements focus proudly upon the care and protection that she provided them. She categorically denied ever seeking out and removing subjects from syphilis clinics, as she has been accused of doing by her superiors, the doctors who engineered and controlled the study. In 1953, Rivers, whose role was that of a caretaker and tracker, not of a research analyst, was listed in the coveted position of first author of a public health reports paper defending the study. Was this an earned scientific laurel, or a cynical ploy to portray the study as one planned and analyzed by a racially mixed group of researchers, rather than by a group of white male scientists? Her role and her own statements suggest the latter. When she was first recruited to enter the study as a scientific assistant, her response had been, "You know, I don't know a thing about it." And this was likely frankness, not false modesty. As a night nurse at the Andrew Hospital, she had little scientific training. Her forte was caring for people. When she is asked about the study details, Rivers' responses are inchoate and echo the cant with which the PHS researchers have agreed to defend themselves, which suggests that Rivers never understood the science behind the study. Her crime was believing the PHS doctors who told her that theirs was beneficent work. However, I cannot completely excuse her, as much as I long to. I wish that she had asked more questions, and once the question of whether the study was ethical had been openly raised in 1965, I wish that she had demanded reassurance on that point, or left the study. Instead, she compounded her error by her continued blind faith in the researchers she had been trained to serve. She failed to see that she had been used as a Judas goat to lure the men into completing their research roles and as a shield to deflect charges of racism. But how do these pallid failings of omission compare to the sinister machinations of PHS officials who deliberately lied, plotted, abused, then deflected blame onto the powerless? Perhaps we should ask ourselves why the name of Nurse Rivers is so closely associated with the Tuskegee syphilis study, but the names of Taliaferro Clark, Thomas Murrell, Raymond Vondelier, and Oliver C. Wegner remain all but unknown. Although at least four full-length books, two feature films, a handful of documentaries, plays, and hundreds of medical, newspaper, and magazine articles have been written about the Tuskegee syphilis study, there are still aspects of the study about which we know little. For example, the interpretations of the study have focused upon the monitoring of the disease's course in the untreated black men. But Benjamin Roy, M.D., an Atlanta psychoneuroimmunologist, has proposed another experimental agenda for the Tuskegee syphilis study. More than a decade ago, Roy discovered that PHS scientists may have used the men to develop a reliable syphilis test and vaccine. The unwitting subjects may have served American laboratories as a reservoir of T. pallidum bacteria. They were human incubators of the bacterium that causes syphilis. A 1995 Harvard Journal of Minority Public Health article by Roy proposes that the experiment's chief medical importance was in providing a reservoir of infected men who could be used to develop new, more reliable, and profitable tests for syphilis. Roy points out that the Public Health Service's study of the men at Tuskegee was only one of a related group of research studies called the Cooperative Clinical Groups. The Tuskegee syphilis study began in 1932, 20 years before scientists learned to culture cells in which to grow pathogens such as the syphilis bacterium. Thus, the development of a sensitive, specific test for syphilis required a constant supply of syphilis, which could not be cultured in the laboratory. This constant need for fresh supplies of blood products that contain the syphilis bacterium explains, among other things, why the study subjects were routinely administered spinal taps and had their blood drawn regularly. PHS documents verify that the sera of the infected Tuskegee subjects was used to develop more reliable tests for syphilis, including the fluorescent treponemal antibody absorption, FTA-ABS, test, and the venereal disease research laboratory, VDRL, test. In 1970, Dr. James B. Lucas of the PHS's venereal disease branch conceded, "Probably the greatest contribution that the Tuskegee study has made and can continue to provide has been documented sera for study in our laboratory. In a great measure, the development and our endorsement of the FTA-ABS test rested on Tuskegee sera. The tests were marketed globally and became quite profitable for the U.S. government because its contract with Alabama's Department of Health specified that any invention arising from the Tuskegee syphilis study would become the sole property of the United States." Among the ruins left in the wake of the Tuskegee syphilis study were the blighted lives and early deaths of hundreds of subjects and their families. But this was only the beginning. The proud, good name of our nation's premier African-American research institution has been forever besmirched. The residual faith in medical science to which communities of disadvantaged black people clung has been blasted so fiercely that physicians and researchers are still dodging the fallout. The health of 30 million African Americans is continually imperiled, partly because many eschew effective care rather than risk the tender mercies of government-sponsored medicine. Although many studies and abuses contributed to this iatrophobia, Tuskegee remains the iconic symbol of racialized medical abuse. The study also left a rich mythical legacy that reveals much about the cultural consequences of the study. But it is essential to separate fact from fiction, because the false beliefs generate false fears that exacerbate black aversion to medical treatment. Perhaps the most persistent myth holds that the PHS actively injected the subjects with syphilis. This falsehood emanated not from overheated African-American imaginations, but from the congressional record and erroneous newspaper accounts. Furthermore, this was an erroneous but not an unrealistic belief, because, as historian Susan E. Lederer reminds us, researchers have injected Americans with gonorrhea, syphilis, and other venereal diseases on at least 40 occasions since 1892, most of which took place in the 20th century. In 1892, Albert Neisser intentionally infected women with syphilis by injecting them with serum from syphilitic patients. Groups consisting only of African Americans have been injected with diseases such as granuloma inguinale and falciparum malaria. J. A. McIntosh of Memphis, Tennessee, boasted in 1926 that he had achieved the first instance of successful experimental transmission of granuloma inguinale from one individual to another, a black man who was not previously exposed in any way to the possibility of spontaneously contracting this disease. another popular myth holds that the study's infected men were soldiers, or were Tuskegee Airmen, which seems a simple erroneous association of the Tuskegee Airmen with Tuskegee Institute. This myth was reinforced when actor Lawrence Fishburne played the lead role in both Miss Evers' Boys, the irresponsibly fictionalized HBO feature based upon the Tuskegee syphilis study, and the television film The Tuskegee Airmen. Yet this myth also reflects a sad acknowledgement that the honor of Tuskegee University, a proud scientific bastion once celebrated as the Black Harvard, also fell victim to this shameful perversion of medical research. Still, it is a mistake to attribute African Americans' medical reluctance to simple fear generated by the Tuskegee syphilis study, because this study is not an aberration that single-handedly transformed African American perceptions of the healthcare system. This study is part of a pattern of experimental abuse, and many African Americans understand it as such, because a rich oral tradition has sustained remembrances of pain, abuse, and humiliation at the hands of physicians. We should remember that, as Vanessa Northington Gamble, M.D., director of Tuskegee University's National Center for Bioethics in Research and Healthcare, averred, many African Americans fear and distrust Western medicine who have never heard of Tuskegee. In 2004, Dr. Stephen Shodeke, assistant director of the Tuskegee Bioethics Center, remarked, one of the huge challenges we have is recruitment of African Americans into clinical trials, and the Tuskegee syphilis study is always cited as one of the reasons why African Americans are reluctant to participate. Too many researchers and social scientists still attribute all African American fears of medical abuse to the Tuskegee syphilis study. Their surveys often frame questions that are limited to this one study. News accounts follow suit, usually attributing all black iatrophobia to Tuskegee. Consider these newspaper and journal excerpts. Congress is posed to consider ill-advised legislation introduced by Representative Gary Ackerman, Democratic New York, that would bar the blind HIV testing of blood samples taken from newborns, writes Ronald Bayer in the Washington Post. According to Bayer, the specter of the Tuskegee syphilis study, the federal experiment that traced the course of the disease in African-American men who were not informed that they had a treatable sexually transmitted disease, surrounds the debate. It's not Tuskegee Revisited. Washington Post, May 26, 1995. Dr. Arthur Ammon, a specialist in pediatric AIDS, compared the anonymous testing of infants in New York to the Tuskegee experiment, in which black men with syphilis were observed but not treated in a government study. The New Tuskegee Experiment, The Village Voice, October 14, 1996. The impact of the Tuskegee study, in which blacks in the South were not treated for syphilis as part of a government study, continues to be felt as the mistrust it generated interferes with attempts to combat AIDS in certain black areas. AIDS education programs in black communities have often prompted the topic of Tuskegee. Tuskegee's long arm still touches a nerve. New York Times, April 13, 1997. The Tuskegee syphilis study ended a quarter of a century ago, but its effects can still be felt. Many African Americans' distrust in today's medical establishment can be attributed to Tuskegee, says Dr. Carl C. Bell, executive director of Chicago's Community Mental Health Council. Mistrust of doctors lingers after Tuskegee. Washington Post, April 15, 1997. The assumed one-to-one correspondence between this study and black distrust is chronicled in hundreds of articles with headlines such as The Ghost of Tuskegee, Close Up, Tuskegee Experiment's Legacy is the Spread of Suspicion, Sour Legacy of Tuskegee Syphilis Study Lingers, Tuskegee Experiment's Legacy, Lack of Trust, Syphilis Study Leaves Legacy of Mistrust, and Clinical Trials, Healthcare, and the Tuskegee legacy. But it is important to look beyond this one study in examining African Americans' aversion to the healthcare system. By focusing upon the single event of the Tuskegee syphilis study, rather than examining a centuries-old pattern of experimental abuse, recent investigations tend to distort the problem, casting African Americans' wariness as an overreaction to a single event, rather than an understandable, reasonable reaction to the persistent experimental abuse that has characterized American medicine's interaction with African Americans. As early as 1997, a few especially perceptive biomedical researchers placed black iatrophobia in the context of a longer history of research abuse and neglect. That year, Emory University's Otis Brawley, MD, told the Journal of Blacks in Higher Education that many researchers believe that because of Tuskegee, it will be so difficult and even impossible to recruit blacks that we shouldn't waste our time. But researchers use Tuskegee as an excuse for laziness. Fortunately, more investigations with fewer leading questions are now being launched, and they will allow us to learn more about the extent of African Americans' awareness concerning the long, unhappy history of medicalized abuse and experimentation. The Tuskegee syphilis study is the longest and the most infamous, but hardly the worst, experimental abuse of African Americans. It has been eclipsed in both numbers and egregiousness by other abusive medical studies, and the balance of this book tells these stories. Subsequent chapters will relate how, after the Tuskegee syphilis study, African Americans' illnesses were not simply observed, but were also induced when subjects were administered toxic substances or deliberately exposed to a wide range of biological hazards, including lethal radiation doses, hazardous experimental technologies, a wide range of untested chemical products, risky non-therapeutic vaccines, and injection with infectious agents. In fact, in the late 1920s and 1930s, the very period when the Tuskegee syphilis study lost its therapeutic arm and mutated into exploitation, an experiment in malaria therapy, conducted under the auspices of the Rockefeller Foundation, was doing worse than allowing black men with syphilis to die. Researchers were killing black syphilitics outright in order to test a theory of treatment. In 1910, New York City was home to the only hospital in the nation that was devoted exclusively to research, the Rockefeller Institute. As mentioned earlier in this chapter, neurosyphilis, or paresis, occurs in late-stage syphilis, affecting the nervous system and causing insanity. In 1910, it was long thought to be a mental ailment, not an infectious one. Dr. Mark Boyd, a researcher funded by the Rockefeller Institute, was testing a novel treatment for neurosyphilis, malaria therapy. Boyd deliberately infected both black and white people suffering from neurosyphilis with malaria in order to generate high fevers, which he hoped would kill the syphilis spirochete. But the blacks in his experiment seemed to resist infection by the relatively benign Plasmodia strain of malaria. So Boyd infected 470 of the syphilitic blacks, but no whites, with the deadly falciparum strain instead, killing some of the black subjects. Boyd did not stop the experiments when blacks began dying. Instead, he resorted to deceit. In his notes, he disguised their causes of death and distorted the death rate of blacks to shroud the fact that they were dying from deliberate infection with falciparum. However, the decision not to treat the sick men of the Tuskegee study is a different crime, a crime of omission, and it illustrates several of the important patterns explored in this book. These include the selection of blacks for the riskiest studies, their disproportionate selection for non-therapeutic experimentation, the myth of medical distinctiveness, which held that syphilis was manifested differently in blacks, and the myth of hypersexed blacks as incorrigible vectors of sexual disease and dysfunction. The use of men as reservoirs of syphilis reinforced the familiar use of black bodies to generate the profitable wonders of new disease approaches, to which the subjects are rarely privy, and the clinical display of disease in the clinic and in medical journals. The defenses of the study all rest upon carefully engineered fictions. Its apologists have claimed that the study was merely a passive observation, a study in nature, but it was not, because researchers actively designed it and lied to participants, promising treatment but actively withholding it. The study cannot be defended on a utilitarian basis because PHS physicians admitted, years before it was ended, that it imparted no new clinical knowledge that would allow them to help future patients. By 1970, James Lucas, assistant chief of the PHS's venereal disease branch, concluded, "Nothing learned will prevent, find, or cure a single case of infectious syphilis or bring us closer to our basic mission of controlling venereal disease in the United States." The study did, however, generate publications, scientific tools, and scientific stature for the PHS researchers. PHS researchers lacked scientific as well as ethical integrity. Early in the experiment, Raymond Vondelier had triumphantly announced that the clinical assessments provided proof of a divergent white and black syphilis. Black syphilitics, he said, clearly suffered primarily cardiovascular complications, whereas whites suffered neurological devastation. But a 10-member Blue Ribbon panel of the American Heart Association disagreed. In 1933, they condemned the data as inaccurately interpreted. The racial dimorphism existed only in the PHS researchers' minds. Yet the experiment in racial comparison was continued, as if this had never been determined. Some claim that the Tuskegee syphilis study was not a racist study because it simply mirrored a parallel study of Norwegian whites by Dr. E. Brusgaard. In 1929, Brusgaard reviewed the charts of 2,000 Oslo-area syphilis patients who, for various reasons, had not received medications between 1891 and 1910. However, equating the Tuskegee study with the Oslo study is inaccurate, because the latter was a retrospective analysis of Norwegian treatment data that had already been collected, not an experiment in malign neglect designed deliberately to withhold treatment from the unwitting. Even if the PHS had used a parallel design, it would be absurd to compare the racial dynamics driving black-white health consumption in segregated Alabama to that of whites in a more racially homogeneous social welfare state such as Norway. Apologists for the study often make the error of assuming that because there were no national laws governing human medical experimentation in the 1930s, there were no ethical strictures upon what a physician could and could not do with his patients. But in the era of the Tuskegee syphilis study, physicians were constrained by hospital regulations and AMA codes to share diagnoses and to request permission for experimentation and usually for treatment, the ethical norm of the time. There were also laws that forbade many of the PHS practices at Tuskegee. Among the examples given by historian Susan Lederer is the 1929 observation by lawyer George Weinman that the unauthorized autopsy of a dead human body is a tort, giving rise to a cause of action for damages. This norm was often violated in the case of African Americans. Transforming the legacy. On May 16, 1997, a quarter of a century after the Tuskegee syphilis study ended, President William Jefferson Clinton formally apologized for the study in a dignified White House ceremony that allowed the mere 8 survivors and their families to join the activists and historians who had championed their cause. To the survivors, to the wives and family members, the children and the grandchildren, I say what you know. No power on earth can give you back the lives lost, the pain suffered, the years of internal torment and anguish. What was done cannot be undone. But we can end the silence. We can stop turning our heads away. We can look at you in the eye and finally say, on behalf of the American people, what the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry. To Macon County, to Tuskegee, to the doctors who have been wrongly associated with the events there, you have our apology as well. To our African-American citizens, I am sorry that your federal government orchestrated a study so clearly racist. That can never be allowed to happen again. Clamorous applause greeted the president's acknowledgement of the racism and immorality of the study. Under the hot press lights, the survivors shared their remembrances and their hope that such an abuse would never be repeated. "It is time," 94-year-old Herman Shaw declaimed, "to put this horrible nightmare behind us as a nation. We must never allow a tragedy like the Tuskegee study to happen again." The apology incorporated a permanent, tangible legacy as well. The Tuskegee University National Center for Bioethics in Research and Healthcare, supported in part by a $200,000 grant President Clinton allocated as part of the apology. It opened May 12, 1998, with the stated goal of training and educating African Americans in bioethics. The center's multi-ethnic staff has forged scholarly partnerships with mainstream bioethics centers at other universities. Unlike other such centers, however, Tuskegee has also invested heavily in community education. More than 30 years after its unmasking, the study still horribly fascinates. It may be the study's essentially vacuous nature, because it embodies coolly designed crimes of omission by featureless government martinets, who illustrate Hannah Arendt's banality of evil to appalling perfection. Or perhaps it is medicine's betrayal by physicians of the public health service, the very government entity charged with protecting our health. Then again, it may have been the carefully orchestrated complicity of so many powerful, privileged physicians utterly bent upon destroying the health of a group of poor, powerless, vulnerable black men. Or the very longevity of the syphilis study may be what holds us in thrall. Discovering a murderously racist experiment that had been secretly coddled from the interbellum era to the Nixon administration is a bit like finding one of those gruesome prehistoric fish, long thought extinct, in the deep end of your swimming pool. The syphilis study, like those Jurassic holdovers, has forced us to confront a living, breathing monster that we would rather have consigned to history. Yet the Tuskegee syphilis study has not really ended, because it continues to fascinate. The flow of books, plays, poems, songs, and films continues as Americans probe and worry the experiment for lessons. I suspect we are partly motivated by our desire to extract some valuable meaning that will produce good as a counterweight to its evil. Maybe what is important is that blacks and whites are united in their outrage over this medical nightmare, and that whites actively attacked this racist viper at the breast of medicine. A white whistleblower challenged the study. A white journalist forced it onto the national stage. And white and black panel members joined to end it. But if we had learned what we should have, this book would stop here. The greatest tragedy of the study is that it failed to serve as a cautionary tale for researchers. Its inception marked the dawn of many other experimental evils against blacks, detailed in the chapters to come.
Context of white supremacy. That will do it for chapter one, or our first audio segment. I can only say, man, just that chapter alone, and I have not read this book before, so I'm going through it for the first time with the folks that are listening in. But I can say just on that chapter alone, and specifically this chapter 7, the audio segment that we just heard, I think my top 10 list of books will be altered to include Harriet Washington's phenomenal work. It is a profound privilege to be reading the book with Cal's listeners. I hope you all are enjoying. But just that chapter alone, wow, brilliant effort by Harriet Washington. The whole book, but I mean that chapter, singularly phenomenal bit of writing and research from Harriet A. Washington. With that, folks would like to chime in, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943 pound. And we got a clean end. That did not just end the chapter, that ended part one of the book. The number again is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943 pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you would like to chime in and you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free vote line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyty.cc/oneRace. The address again, tinyty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. When you put in that address, click the link on the left of the page. It says free vote line. Once you click that link, it will open a small window on your screen. On the top line, select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. On the next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. The final line, it will ask for a name. You can use a real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom, and it will connect you to the live line. You should be able to hear the broadcast, and it's the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. Once you do that, you will hear an audio prompt. Press the number 1, and we will get you on the line. With that, we really haven't had much of a problem, but again, we're not deviating, so if you have things that are not related to medical apartheid, save it for tomorrow. The folks that dialed in, if you have commentary, your line should be open. Feel free.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. happy that we finished the first part here. But I'd like to do a correction from last week. I think I said that the wives and the children of the Tuskegee experiment victim were not mentioned in Bad Blood, but I went back and looked. It wasn't specifically in the book, but one of the footnotes from chapter 13, you know, referred to the 40 or 50 wives and 19 or 20 children that was also affected, you know, either contracting syphilis from the victims or congenitally being born with it. I found it, you know, astonishing that the Surgeon General on page 167, you know, a guy that, you know, had aspirations to, you know, eradicate syphilis in his time, wrote a book and all this, and he actually signed off on the experiment. So it just gives us, you know, an idea of, you know, the hardball that's being played here, because they just, it says the Tuskegee syphilis study a pool of syphilis patients would never come again and must be exploited. Those were his feelings. And then it comes down to the fact that the reason why they were doing this experiment was to keep a pool of men so that they could send these cultures out because they couldn't produce them in a laboratory. Imagine people sacrificing their lives, you know, and bad health for 40, 50 years behind some experiment, and government sanctioned at that. But then the whistleblower, Pete Buxton, so-called whistleblower, you know, and they point out the fact that he's Polish, you know, and the book referred to, they brought him in a meeting, you know, he was an employee too, but he got wind of the experiment was going on. They had to bring him in a meeting, explain to him, hey, look, this is the way, you know, that white supremacy works. You know, these people are useless. And sure, it's going on, but it's going to continue. And so I guess the guy stayed with it, but then 7 years passed before, you know, anything could really be done. And I hadn't even got to the ad hoc panel. You know, it seems to me, I'll just sum all this up, it seems to me the ad hoc panel was a damage control panel. They went in, they had all different types, politicians, psychiatrists, and this guy was supposed to be an expert in ethics. And then they destroyed the tape. I mean, we can see what their object was by going there. And then briefly mention about Fred Gray, the Mason County attorney that, you know, filed a lawsuit in behalf of the victims. But then it doesn't, you know, look right. When he gets $1 million and the actual participants, people who suffered, only get $37,000, and the one in the control group got even less, and I think it's $15,000 for the children. It's, you know, this thing stinks, you know, to the high heavens in every aspect. So, at first it was puzzling how Ron Brown would be on the panel, and then they destroy evidence. And then Butler, Dr. Butler, who was the president of Dillard University, see, he was also a preacher, too. So, you know, Christianity comes into play here, where it's being used also by the system, and then victims are put out front as front people, you know, to absorb the blow, and then no white person is ever accused or even prosecuted for all the atrocities and crimes that they committed. But I'll mute my line and get somebody else a chance. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
Yes, sir.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Can I be heard?
Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Hello, everyone. To Gus and the other Cal's listeners, calling from the 712. When they said, when they had that, because I was listening to the last episode at work just today, and I listened to it, and I said, and I have the book downloaded. I didn't read ahead. And I was just thinking that they was going to end up trying to try Nurse Rivers on trial for it, because I didn't know much about the Tuskegee Institute. I was under the impression that they were injecting the people with the syphilis. So I had no idea. So I'm so glad we're reading this book and learning more about it. But I said, I wonder, are they going to try that woman in court? And it looked like they might have. But they destroyed the tape. That's supposed to be the reason why. And I just said, oh. And they never get charged, like the previous caller was saying. They do everything they want to do on the planet, and they never get charged for it. And I'm glad we're reading this book, because this, I mean, I have children, so this, they have to read this book before they go off to college, and it's very important. So thank you so much, and I'll mute my line.
Yes, ma'am. Thomas in New York.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Mr. Demery, the lady who just called from the 712. And I have to agree with you, Gus. This is this chapter was quite a read so far. This is something that I will internalize and take with me forever. I often dream, you know, my dream is what happened when we take power, and boy, whew, just got a lot more brutal for them. I believe they said that Bill Clinton apologized. So we're looking at between 1992 and 2000, years later, and he allocated $300,000 to a monument or something, for like $300,000. Like, ugh. You know, just to think, syphilis, I think it comes from people sleeping with animals, sheep or dogs. So this is a white person disease that they probably spread amongst the slaves through rape. And now they're experimenting on it, trying to figure out how to cure it, I'm sure, for white people. And just all around tackiness. And I know we have a lot of people on hold, so I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Great to see you guys. To Thomas in New York, Mr. Demery, and all the other callers. I am so upset with myself that I missed the first half of the reading. I came in at the very end. I had to take care of something during that part of the program. But I'm definitely going to be chiming in for the second half. But I just wanted to just speak to something that we've been seeing throughout the reading of the book, which is the misunderstanding of the system of white supremacy by the author, in the way that sometimes she doesn't always give them the responsibility they're due as far as understanding that these people are racist. At certain times, she has said that certain racist doctors were not racist and gave her reasoning. And I thought either the editors themselves made some serious, serious changes to her writing, or if those writings in which she kind of let things lay in a way in which it seemed like these people were more human than racist, that could also, if that is authentically her ideas, that can also, I think, speak volumes to the depth of our mental illness, because for someone who is as profoundly intelligent as she is and has done such diligent research, even for someone as informed as her, it is hard to make those same connections that these people are racist across the board. And to me, that if that is truly her writing and not something where the editors have doctored it in order to take the blame and responsibility away from white supremacists, then to me, I think those specific things are a great example. It's not to denigrate her in any way. I just think it's something that we can look at as far as just analyzing that psychology that we've been inculcated with. And like I said, it's only if it's authentic, because like I was saying before, the editors might have really had a field day as far as editing things to make white people look less predatory than they actually are. So if that is the case, and that is her writing as far as those misgivings or misunderstandings about the way white people function, to me, those examples could be profound examples we can learn from as far as understanding the way white people function. And I'm looking so forward to hearing the archive of the first half and chiming in on the second half. And thank you so much for choosing this book, Gus, and big ups to you for such incredible work. Thank you.
Listeners voted for this one. This was not Gus T. Renegade, but for sure. Anybody else that we have not heard from? Did you all have commentary you wanted to get in?
Yeah, be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, this was a very good chapter. In the first day, I thought that we're reading it, the first thing I thought of was the Dred Scott decision. Black man has no rights, but a white man has to be set. And then as I read on, they did another study with black females, with Albert Messier on page 178 also affected women with the syphilis, and then the meager amount that was awarded to them, just $37,000 that was awarded to them. It's just such a new thought. But more so, as anyone on page 185, it talked about how because it continues to fascinate the prestigious experiment, the flow of books and plays and poems and songs. Well, plays is sort of sticking out in my mind. I mean, I can't imagine them making a play out of this. So anyone have any ideas on what that play may look like? I would appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Anybody else that we have not heard from? If you had commentary, feel free.
Good evening, everyone. It's Carmen. And maybe this is my imagination, but it seems like there was a play about it. And Nurse was it Rivers? She was like the heroine of the play. And it was like off Broadway. Maybe I'm wrong, but maybe I'm older, though. My observation is that obviously white people all over the country, all over the world, were absolutely obsessed about finding a cure for syphilis. So what I have learned is whatever white people accuse black people of is exactly what they are, because they're just strange. So there's because that phrase, the most syphilitic soaked group of people. White people are not going to spend that kind of money doing research to take care of any disease that is primarily wiping out black people. So this was research funded by the government of intense interest to white people, because they were the ones who were suffering from it. All right. The other thing that that struck my mind was, you know, I think this is a wake-up call for me, because I always think of black people not being told what their different blood is used for, their body parts are being used for, their donations were, just not being informed. But the thing that struck me as more horrible is that, you know, that black people are never even informed that we're in the midst of an experiment. I think they must be running all kinds of studies on us all the time, and we are never informed that we are being experimented on. That has to be more horrible than anything else. And another thing, when you're on the right track, when white people know more about practicing racism than you do, and you accidentally hit on that, the response of white people is, as Gus always says, crickets. I was reading this book, and earlier we were talking about all kinds of things politically related. I have too much of an echo. I can't continue. I'm sorry. Someone else can speak.
I think the echo should be gone if you want to proceed.
Okay. Well, we were talking about, you know, the prison thing and black women not being cared about when they've been hot and stuff like that. And so a couple of hours later, that person says, well, you know, Karma, everything's not racially related. Why do you always see that? A couple hours later, I'm reading this book, and that same person says, what are you reading? And I said, it's a book about medical experiments on black people in the United States. That is literally the response I got. I mean, nothing. It was like I hadn't heard a word. Every time I accidentally hit on an irrefutable racist thing, nothing from white people. I could be playing them a tape. Nothing. It's like there were no words said. I'm starting to see this as a pattern. And then it was saying, oh, you know, trying to make the white people look more humane, just like the caller was saying earlier. It had to be a white journalist. It had to be, you know, a white whistleblower. I said, yeah, because when the black people, I'm sure black people tried to blow the whistle on this. 40 years, please, and you're around black people? Black people are very astute. I am sure the black people tried to blow the whistle on this, but no one hears black people. No one hears black people when they start charging racism ever. So So, of course, it had to be a white whistleblower, and, of course, it had to be a white journalist. I mean, that only makes sense. It's not white people being so much more astute or so much more given to what's going on or being capable. It's just it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. You have to be white if you're going to say anything. All right. I think. Yes. I discovered a long time ago that any talk of healthcare in places like Texas or the United States, then everybody wants to riot because when he was talking about the racially homogeneous social welfare state like Norway, you can do an experiment and it doesn't have to turn sadistic. Well, that's because it's racially homogeneous. I mean, in the United States, any kind of medical thing is going to be death, torture, mistreatment. But if you have a racially homogeneous state, they may manage to do medicine without actually torturing the victims. All right, that's it. Thank you.
For sure. Anybody that we missed? Anybody who has not commented at all? We got everybody. Everybody who has a hand up has been able to comment. All right. Let's make sure we do not wait till the last minute when we get ready to hit the second audio segment. We still have about a good 30 minutes, so you should have ample time if you have commentary that you want to get in. I just will add quickly to what Karma was saying. I think it's not. It is when they have a predominantly white population. I think if it was a homogeneous population where it was exclusively black people, it would be the exact same thing, where they would be terrorizing black people. And I think she even started with some of that at the beginning of the book. It's just that Norway, they have pretty much exclusively white people. They don't have a whole lot of dark people. So it's, you know, hey, we can do studies and nobody will be harmed. Some of the notes that I had, number one, reading the newspaper, or I guess the caller that asked about the play. People know about the movie, Mrs. Evers' Boys, the HBO production. I had multiple thoughts on that because HBO is doing a movie on Henrietta Lacks. I did not know until I heard Mr. Herman Shaw, where he made comments about Mrs. Evers' Boys, saying that that is nonsense, that that is a ridiculous portrayal of he and the other black victims of the Tuskegee study. It even took me a moment, I am a victim, forgive, for me to even think that these black males, these victims being referred to as boys, where they were quote-unquote adults who were well beyond their 30s, many of them, when this happened, but they're still referred to as boys. But he took offense at it, just showing them as being these kind of dancing clowns messing around that she goes out in the Alabama woodlands to do these studies. But the play it's by the same name, Mrs. Evers' Boys, and they adapted that play to the HBO film. But that is something to keep in mind when the HBO Henrietta Lacks production comes out, whenever it does, which is supposed to involve Oprah Winfrey, so I have been told. Anywho, I was checking the New York Times today, and they had a report. It was on the front page, and it was about New York University. They had bodies that had been donated, and per the donor's request, after they donated their bodies to science for medical research, whatever they're going to do, they're supposed to be cremated. It's supposed to be some dignified ceremony and cremate the bodies. They didn't do that. The remains ended up being dumped in a mass grave at Potter's Field in New York. They had done an extensive write-up on this in the New York Times magazine earlier this month, and then they had the follow-up to it in the New York Times today. And it was many interesting aspects. This is on my Facebook page. I put it in the Facebook group as well. But one of the interesting aspects in the article is that they had all these photographs of some of the victims, people who donated their body for research. They're all white who did this, and I felt that that was strategic to play on the sympathy, like, oh, man, I can't believe that they would do this to these good white people, some of them who they even talk about, you know, these folks had a lot of money and they had, you know, posh places in New York, posh residences in New York. And, you know, they do this thinking that they're doing something to support the sciences and scholarly efforts. And this is how their remains are treated. That was number one. Number two, they don't make any mention of racism, right? Harriet Washington's work. I mean, this is a big part of her chapter that we talked about, I believe, the week before last, and the grave robbing of black corpses and what have you. That's a long tradition in this area of the world. They move on in the paragraph. They move to Detroit. I'm pulling it up now if you all want to check it out. It's called Bodies Given to NYU Ended Up in Mass Graves Despite Donors' Wishes. And this is from today. This is on the New York Times website. It's been my experience. Things that are on the website end up being in the physical paper the next day. So if you get the physical paper, it might be there tomorrow if you want to check it out. But they talked about Detroit specifically. But let's see if I can read that portion really quick, because I thought that was the racism aspect was right here. So it reads, let's see. Oh, it dropped down. I just had the page pulled up and it dropped down. If it takes takes too long to pull up, then I'll just go ahead to get to some of my other notes and then I'll get back to reading. But I just had it in the screen. Oh, okay, here we go. All right, so it reads. There continues to be a need for comprehensive laws and policies to allow a layperson to understand the choice they are making, Ms. Schmidt said, of body donation. It is absolutely essential to have an institution's leadership involved and have strong policies and procedures in place that are not a secret. In recent years, body donation operations of various kinds have been enmeshed in scandals. Federal raids on anatomical donation companies in several states led to criminal indictments this year after more than 1,000 decaying body parts were discovered in a shabby Detroit warehouse. They had been supplied and sold for profit without the donor's consent. I think we've talked about that concept before, or at least I have, that racists just do whatever they want. They don't really need black people's consent about anything. In another case, George Washington University's medical school, I think that's in Washington, D.C., medical school announced that it had lost track of the identities of about 50 donated cadavers used to train future doctors, and families were suddenly left to wonder whether they had been sent the wrong ashes. Just those two in particular, Washington, D.C. and Detroit, large populations of black people, and particularly for the one in Detroit where they're saying that they had more than 1,000 decaying body parts were discovered. There's no way that that could be happening in Detroit and not have a sizable, I would say probably a massively disproportionate number of those corpses belonging to black people. But that was just in the New York Times today. And the article, again, you can check it out, is Bodies Given to NYU Ended Up in Mass Graves Despite Donors' Wishes. Back to the book. Just an incredible chapter all the way around for so many reasons. I thought of Henrietta Lacks repeatedly throughout this chapter. We read Rebecca Skloot, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, another illustration of black people being pillaged, black bodies being plundered for white profit. I also thought of Ayikwee Armah, 2000 Seasons, since I mentioned my top 10 book list. The passage he has at the very beginning, "For whose entertainment shall we sing our agony?" I think it's so fitting that she included Sarki Bartman and Oda Benga and Joyce Heth at the beginning of this book. Black suffering for white display, just so that we can spectate. We even reminded of Amy Louise Wood, her book Lynching Spectacle. There is a long tradition of just white people enjoying being able to ogle black suffering and death. And that seems to be a big, I mean, for 40 years to watch these black Alabamans suffer and die just so that they can write, even when there's no possible medical benefit. Like, this is not going to even benefit white people. Like, we're just watching them suffer and die, and deliberately lying to them and withholding treatment, them and their families and children that are being infected and impacted by this. We're just watching just for white racist amusement and entertainment. That is extraordinary, something that shouldn't be lost, because that seems to be a broad pattern in the system of white supremacy. And this is James Jones' Bad Blood. Even after you started to have some white people coming out and saying, "Hey, you shouldn't be doing this. We shouldn't be doing this. This should be stopped," they were still saying, you know, this might come out But I think we should keep doing this. Let's see if we can put our brains together and figure out a way that we can keep allowing these niggers to suffer and watching them, even if it should come out. Let's see if we can sit down and think about a way to do that. I know we talked about that with James Jones, and it's in his book, Bad Blood. Some of the other notes that I had, the passage, let's see. Well, I can't give out the page numbers again. I don't have the electronic copy, so my pages won't match up. So in the subsection of Chapter 7, cover up the ad hoc panel, the section where it says Secretary Duval petulantly cast himself in the role of masochistic victim, declaring, "I wanted a panel that would be sympathetic to the public point of view rather than to the scientific or factual point of view, so I loaded it with angry blacks. That way there could be no criticism." There are many aspects of that that could be interrogated. The thing that I started with was just masochistic. Definition for masochistic: deriving sexual gratification from one's own pain or humiliation. I thought that was a profound choice of wording from Miss Washington, that that's what she felt was happening with this panel construction, to allegedly load it with angry Negroes so that there could be no criticism and that they would properly castigate the folks who put this study together. That would be number one. I think some of you all already touched on kind of the cynical nature of giving the appearance to showcase some black people out front to make it look like we're going to do the correct thing. And then once this panel and they do all their cover up and destruction of evidence and the recording of Eunice Rivers and some of the other firsthand accounts, and it does not properly indict, they're not given proper time to do excellent work, then it can be, hey, we had all these black people on the panel. I mean, hey, what are you talking about? Can't be racism. Look at this. We've had all these black people on here. We loaded it with black people purposely. So if there's going to be any blame, make sure you get these black people up front. Just in my view, they racists are so cunning. They're so skilled at doing this sort of work. They are methodical when they make these sort of efforts, when they know they have no interest, they have no possible way that they're going to do the correct thing at any point in time. We'll just make sure that even once we get the panel, the investigation together, we'll even make sure that that is done properly to serve racist interests. And we can showcase black people so that they will catch the blame when folks get upset about that process as well. Some of the other things that stood out. Wow, there was so much in the chapter. I'm trying to focus on some of the things that I thought were superly important. Them asking for extensions where they were not given adequate time. I know this is something I even spoke about with Mr. Fuller, how they will spend years on studies. I remember the rape cases at Penn State with Jerry Sandusky, where they spent a lot of time and money. Matter of fact, I even remember the case with Mr. Incognito, for the former Miami Dolphins football player, where he was making racist comments at some of his black teammates and some of the non-white people who were on the Dolphins team at that time. They spent about 6-7 months and who knows how much money going through and interviewing people. There was no rush. Take as much time as you need. They hired an independent firm. Like, white people can spend all the money, all the time doing investigations to make sure that they produce, you know, some big bulky, you know, 800 or 8,000 page report when they want to get to the bottom of things, when they want to discover the truth and make sure that they, you know, dig as much as they can, talk to everybody. They know how to do things to make a proper investigation. They clearly had no interest in doing that on this one. I think that's important, too. That's when you can tell we have no interest. We already know that we're not going to do the correct thing here. We're not going to indict anybody. We already know that we're going to do a great job of obfuscating our criminal terroristic behavior, and we're just not even going to give them the time, and we're not going to give them proper documentation. I thought she pointed that out as well later on in this chapter, that they were kind of vetting what information they had access to and not being able to go through the National Archives to get more data, to get an accurate portrayal, accurate perception about what was done for these four decades to these black citizens. Let's see. What else did I pick out? all the language. The portion where she says that in terms of this panel, the surviving panelists say that they felt it critically important to present a unanimous report, so they argued long and bitterly until, at Butler's urging, they adopted a softer version whose language was less critical, among other changes. The less confrontational new version deleted references to intentional racism. That is something that I harp on this program all the time. Number one, the importance of language, using the most accurate terms. Racists are phenomenal. That is one of their primary tactics. We're not going to call it white supremacy. We're going to call it white privilege. We're going to call it prejudice. We're going to call it discrimination. We might not even use those terms at all. We'll call it a microaggression. We'll come up with some other nonsense to move away from calling this what it actually is: deliberate, willful, intentional racism. They consistently make every effort to move away from categorizing things accurately so as that whites will not be indicted, even when you have obvious, egregious acts of white terrorism, like what happened here for 40 years. And even, I think this is important too, because I'm sure some people would probably want to get at the black people who were participants on this panel and say they were coons, they were Sambos, you know, these no good Uncle Tom Negroes. Extremely important, the passage where she said Brandt's work made it painfully clear, says Cass, that the panel had been sabotaged by government staff they relied on for information. It was the first time I had heard about these documents, when they talked about the National Archives, where it had additional information about what they had been doing all of these years. That, in my opinion, is so crucial, where they can set black people up for failure. Even reminds me of the last book that we did with Henrietta Lacks. A Foot in Each World, where she talked about Leonida McLean, where she talked about how white people had the ability to put a black person in charge. She was talking about politics and some sort of government position where they can put you in charge, but they already know they've set you up to fail, whether it's they've messed the budget up or whatever. They already know this is not going to work out for you, so that you will end up looking stupid by the time all of this concludes. It seems like they did the exact same thing with this quote-unquote ad hoc panel. And the failure to include a historian, I think that's important as well. That might be one of those Dr. Welsing moments in terms of connecting the dots, where this is not an isolated incident of racist medical experimentation on black people, that there is a long history of this activity against black people in this part of the world. Let's see. Oh, man. When she gets to the, in my view, totally incorrect and racist focused on exclusively the black people who participated in all of this. Again, I can't do the page number because I have the electronic book, Black Antiheroes in White is the subheading, where she says the roles of some African Americans in the study have been exaggerated. In 1995, Dr. Henry Foster's nomination as Surgeon General was derailed by accusations, which he denies, that he attended a meeting where the Tuskegee syphilis study was discussed, and the resultant media uproar castigated Foster for failing to denounce or to end the study. Foster denied knowing anything about the study before the news media exposed it in 1972, even though no one could demonstrate that he had been present. The very accusation was enough to end his hopes for appointment. By contrast, no news accounts have censored or identified the scores of white AMA members at a 1965 meeting where the Tuskegee syphilis study was reported on in great detail. For that matter, the public health service physicians responsible for the study have never been charged or punished. Extremely important paragraph. They don't even have any evidence that this black male, Dr. Foster, was involved, participated, knew anything. Just it gets floated out there and it messes up his whole career. Meanwhile, none of the white people who were involved at this have been charged. Their reputations have not been besmirched. Sterling, in my view, illustration of racism, white supremacy. And I think this should be paired with the section we got last week where she said that black physicians were not allowed to be members of the American Medical Association, the AMA. They were not allowed to be members up until well into the 1960s, and that black physicians were deliberately denied information about what was happening at this. I think that's something that should be kept in mind as well when we make our assessment about what we think about possible black involvement in this, and if they're culpable, that they should be blamed for what happened. Very next paragraph where she goes to Eunice Rivers, all-star writing, in my opinion. Eunice Rivers, a modestly educated black nurse nurse in the profoundly segregated rural Alabama of the 1940s occupied the lowest rung in the medical hierarchy. Hers was an era when a nurse was a handmaiden trained to assist, not to question the physician, and a black nurse occupied an even lower professional stratum than a white one. Yet Rivers came to shoulder the burden of America's most infamous instance of medical research abuse. She has been accused of retaining men in an experiment that she knew could only harm them, but all her spontaneous statements focus proudly upon the care and protection that she provided them. She categorically denied ever seeking out or removing subjects from syphilis clinics, as she has been accused of doing by her superiors, the doctors who engineered and controlled the study. In 1953, Rivers, whose role was that of a caretaker and tracker, not of a research analysis, was listed in the coveted position of first author of a public health reports paper defending the study. Was this an earned scientific laurel or a cynical ploy to portray the study as one planned and analyzed by a racially mixed group of researchers rather than by a group of white male scientists? Her role and her own statements suggest the latter. When she was first recruited to enter the study as a scientific assistant, her response had been, "You know, I don't know a thing about it." And this was likely frankness, not false modesty. As a night nurse at the Andrew Hospital, she had little scientific training. Her forte was caring for people. I will stop there. Monumentally important section of the book, in my opinion. And they just had a report. It was on NPR. I have to post it on the front page, but they were just talking about this, whose name gets to go first when they have these studies out. And the report was not about racism. It was about sexism. They were saying that females' names rarely get to the front of these articles when they go to post whose name is first, and that's important in terms of credit and your career and all of that. And they were saying how it's male dominated. The fact that you could have a study at this time in 1953, no less, and they put her name first, categorical, diabolical act of racism, white supremacy, to grab the person who knows the least, like grabbing the janitor as, oh yeah, this is the person who's in charge of the study. She's running, we're all just following Nurse Rivers' lead on this one. She's the expert on this one. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I know people have commented about Nurse Rivers and black culpability in general. This is why I say consistently in the system of racism, white supremacy, all of the blame should start and end with whites. I just looking logically at this, there's no way I can fuss at Nurse Rivers about her involvement with this at all. I'm not even sure how much she would have known about this. I don't think any of us can even fathom. Alabama, this is like Birmingham. Matter of fact, this is happening 40 years before the bombing of that church in Alabama. This is happening 40 years before Bull Connor sicked those dogs on those children in Alabama. I don't think any of us could begin to fathom being a black person, male or female, in Alabama at this time and thinking that you're going to question a white person, period. White doctor, a white janitor, a white teacher, a white police officer, a white person, a white child, period, about what they're doing, whether they're doing something incorrect to black people. Are you practicing racism? You're going to stand up and ask them questions as a black person at this time in Alabama. I don't think any of us, or I won't say it that way, I seriously doubt how many of us would have the courage and or the information to be able to do that, and which questions to ask to figure out what was happening exactly with all of this, and to challenge them that you shouldn't be doing this. And I'm going to speak up and say something about this. I wonder, it's easy to sit back in 2016 and say what you would have done. I seriously doubt how many of us in that circumstance would have been, yeah, I'm going up here and I'm going to question them and I'm going to make sure that they stop doing this, like, immediately. Anyway, she goes on. She says she can't completely excuse Nurse Rivers. I just read what I just said. I don't know how much she would have known at the time. And just being a black person under these conditions where you could die at the drop of a hat for anything, for looking at a black person wrong, I just don't know how much I could expect her to do under these conditions. It seems that she earnestly may have felt she was trying to do the best that she could. in trying to care for these black people under terrible situations. It's just, it's hard for me to exonerate her for anything. If I'm going to get on my blaming and pointing a finger, the white people would be named. I would be going after them, not Nurse Rivers, for anything. I do wish they had kept the tapes so that we could hear what it is that she had to say. I also think extremely important what she said about Benjamin Roy in terms of them keeping these black males infected so that they have a culture of reliable syphilis test and vaccine subjects to test and experiment on. Extremely important, Henrietta Lacks. The only other thing, I think it's also important that Tuskegee University being besmirched in all of this, having this connected to a black institution so that they are vilified in perpetuity. I think that is extremely important. It's not Harvard. It's not Auburn. It's not the University of Alabama that gets besmirched with this. It is an HBCU that gets besmirched with this, which in my view just further shows the overarching dominance of racism, white supremacy, and how they can control what's going to happen even under a quote-unquote black sphere. Many other things I could just phenomenal passage, this chapter alone, why I think this will be a top 10 book for Gus T. Renegade. Folks have any commentary on what she laid out about Nurse Rivers? Anybody want to comment? Nurse Rivers, you still think she's culpable or should get some of the blame or what have you? Any comments on that specifically?
Can I be heard?
I don't think she's to blame at all. She's a victim. They're trying to act like that woman, you know, had the labs or whatever. Like, she set the whole thing up. That's why when I said, when I heard it at work, and I didn't read ahead or anything, I said, I bet they're going to try to charge that woman. And they were going to, and then they're going to try to say, well, we can't bring the tape out. And they kind of made it seem like it was because of Nurse Rivers. They were trying to save her, and we can't bring out the Tuskegee experiment as being demonic because we're trying to save Nurse Rivers. She is a victim in this. Go ahead.
I have a comment. Of course, white people are to blame. White people have all the, they have everything they need to get everything set up. But I will tell you this, as someone who has worked in healthcare, you can spot when people are being mistreated. It doesn't take you for decades to realize that all your patients are dying, and especially if white people haven't perfected the game of refining their racism, you know exactly who they are when they walk in the door. And if anyone has had a consistent view of what they are doing to your patients, it is you. So, no, she didn't set up the experiment. She wasn't the bad guy, and she didn't murder anybody. But I really respect that people are able to put one and one together and get two, especially when they give you one on either side. You get to be wrong once. So, no, I'm sure she saw what was going on. I'm sure she figured it out. White people weren't, you know, hiding anything, trying to be anybody's best friend. So, yeah, she did. She just didn't say anything. I said, even if you're afraid of white people, when you're around your people, what's it going to kill you to say, you know, I wouldn't drink that if I were you. So, yeah, I'm sure she's not the bad guy, but no, she's not that stupid. After 40 years of observing your patients closer than anyone else and you see they're all dying, no, she figured something out at some point. She just decided not to say anything.
Can I be heard?
Just being factual, all of them didn't die. We heard Herman Shaw at the beginning of this audio clip in 1996, I believe, speaking at the memorial. So all of them didn't die, and white people were hiding information. I think she makes that point repeatedly in the book, that they were deliberately hiding information from other black medical staff members, just making sure we're being totally accurate.
The last one died in he died in 2004. I'm sorry, go ahead. My problem.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to chime in on that because I definitely agree that that's why I said last week I did not blame her because I had a feeling that there was information missing in which they were going to make her the culpable fall person. It kind of reminds me of President Obama, David Dinkins, Harold Washington. Anytime you see a black person put into a position that seems like it's powerful, they're usually taking the reins from white people that have done the most horrible things, and they become the scapegoat and they get the blame for it. And that's exactly what I felt about with Nurse Rivers. And if we study history, that is something that they do repeatedly. They constantly push that showcase black person to the forefront, and all of the evil and iniquity that they work in secret. These white people, like I said, are never named, they're never prosecuted, and this is just the entire rhetorical, ethical history of white supremacy. And I wanted to touch on, Gus, you brought up, and this is why I really wish I didn't miss the first section, when you talked about Dr. Washington bringing up sadomasochism, and when you read the meaning of sadomasochism, it kind of takes me back to the Delectable Negro. And I think a lot of black people don't understand that they derive sexual pleasure from genociding black people, from terrorizing and raping black people, and even in the medical experimentation, there is a sexual connotation to the destruction and the consuming of black bodies in every form, whether it's literal, literal, figurative, and otherwise. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You know, after reading and hearing a little bit more about Nurse Rivers, you know, I do have, you know, somewhat of a little more sympathy. I read somewhere where when she was a little girl, her father, you know, experienced racism from the KKK, where they shot into the house, and her and her mother had to leave town while he stayed there on the farm. And he took her out of a missionary school because it was only white instructors after a certain grade. So it doesn't sound like her father was ignorant about racism. And I have a hard time believing that, you know, she, you know, didn't have some knowledge of, you know, to be cautious around white people. I'll just say she won't be getting the Harriet Tubman Award anytime soon, but, you know, we'll give her a break. And the whole thing is nothing was accomplished by this experiment. The things that they found out, they already knew. And it's just a horrible thing, and they didn't get compensated properly for it either. I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening. I have a tendency to sometimes look at history from today's perspective, and you did a great job of pointing it out. In the day and time in which this happened, she probably didn't have a choice. And it's sad. However, she did it for a long time. And I'm sure she was probably helpful to them, but, you know, I guess she would get a pass based off of, I mean, this was, what year was this? I mean, this was tough for her to say no. Now, also in the chapter, the author, I believe it was the author's words, and she could have been quoting someone else, but she pointed out about the movie, Miss Evers' Boys, and she mentioned Lawrence Fishburne portrayal of a CEA man, how this is historically inaccurate. And this is one of those cases where, you know, white people are most to blame as well. Of course, Lawrence Fishburne didn't produce that movie. He didn't make it. He didn't write it. It was written by the play was written by a Jewish white person, and the movie screenplay was written by a Jewish white person. It also came out on HBO, Time Warner. So this was not Lawrence Fishburne's. He was just an actor getting paid to do the movie. And I think that the way that movie came off was. Very the way they did it, it wasn't done in an anti-black way. I think it was done very, very smart and skillfully, because everyone heard of this Stevie Ehrman. And everyone has a certain epiphany toward them. And they're like heroes. And to have it happen to them, and for black people to see that visual, to me, that's great. Because it's like, man, they'll do this to anyone. If that's the case, then I'm beating my line.
Anybody who wanted to comment on the nurse service before we get to the second audio? Oh, we had people that we'll get our caller at 4231. 4231, you'll be the last person we get before we get to the second audio clip. 4231, did you have a comment?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to say that I think that the nurse was under threat, duress, and coercion from the existence of racism, white supremacy, sophisticated terrorism. And also that the system of racism, white supremacy was the reason that we would, you know, interpret her as a hostile, when it's really the system of racism, white supremacy, and the advocates of that, and whether they be known or unknown. And I wonder, was any Freemasonry involved in this, or amongst the black people playing as a factor as well? And that's all I wanted to say.
Right on. If folks have other comments on the first portion of the book, I see other hands came up. I said not to wait until we get to the second audio. Now you have to wait until we get done the second audio to share your comments. You could just make a note, and I will say this before we even get to the end of the second audio. Do not wait until the end of the program to dial in and decide that you have a comment you would like to share. Go ahead and get your hand up. The people that did not get to share, I'll make sure you get to go first as soon as the second audio segment ends. If you have commentary on Nurse Rivers or anything else that we heard from Chapter 7. So we are picking up. This is Part 2. I think Roz made the comment about at the end of the book where she says that blacks and whites were united in their outrage over this medical nightmare, and that whites were actively attacked this racist viper at the breast of medicine. A white whistleblower challenged the study. A white journalist forced it into the national stage, and white and black panel members joined to end it. In my view, that is cutting racist a bit too much slack, and we would not have a whole nother half of the book to go if that were not so. Part 2, The Usual Suspects, Medical Chapter 8, The Black Stork, The Eugenic Control of African-American Reproduction. Oh, my. Context of White Supremacy, audio
part
segment
two.
Number 2, Harriet Washington's
The Usual Subjects.
Medical Apartheid.
Chapter 8, The Black Stork, The Eugenic Control of African-American Reproduction. We don't allow dogs to breed. We spay them. We neuter them. We try to keep them from having unwanted puppies. And yet these women are literally having litters of children. Barbara Harris, founder of Children Requiring a Caring Community, CRAC, C. 1990. National Socialism is Nothing But Applied Biology. Rudolf Hess, Berlin, 1934. She might easily have endured the life of quiet desperation dictated by her birth, then vanished without a ripple. The granddaughter of a slave, the daughter of sharecroppers, and younger sister to 19 siblings, she was intelligent, hardworking, and loved to read, but she was also dark-skinned, uneducated, and a woman, a recipe for failure in rural Mississippi. The year was 1961, but it might as well have been 1861. She helped her family eke a hard-scrabble existence on a plantation in Sunflower County by picking 300 to 400 pounds of cotton a day for $1 a hundredweight. They spent their days exhausted, hungry, and shabbily garbed, but her family never earned enough to break the cycle of debt and remained trapped in the usurious later-day slavery called sharecropping. But she was not angry. A deeply religious person, she focused her energies on helping others and eagerly awaited the day she would have her own family. Her name was Fannie Lou Hamer. One day in 1961, Hamer entered the hospital to have a knot on my stomach, probably a benign uterine fibroid tumor, removed. Then she returned to her family's shack on the plantation to recuperate. But in the big house, ominous tidings circulated. The owner's wife, Vera Alicia Marlowe, was a cousin of the surgeon who had treated Hamer. Marlowe gossiped to the cook that Hamer had lost more than a tumor while unconscious. The surgeon had removed her uterus, rendering Hamer sterile. The cook repeated the news to others, including a woman who happened to be Hamer's cousin. And thus, Hamer was one of the last people on the plantation to learn that she would never have a family of her own. I went to the doctor who did that to me, and I asked him, why? Why had he done that to me? He didn't have to say nothing, and he didn't. If he was going to give that sort of operation, then he should have told me. I would have loved to have had children. But a lawsuit was out of the question, Hamer recalled. At that time? Me? Getting a white lawyer against a white doctor? I would have been taking my hands and screwing tacks in my casket. A rage seized her, and she complained bitterly about her fate. But she also grew fascinated by political power as a means to redress injustice, and soon she did the unthinkable. She tried to register to vote. But she was rejected at the polling booth, and when she arrived home, the angry owner threw her off the plantation where she had lived for 19 years. It didn't matter, because Hamer was no longer a sharecropper. She was now an uncompromising political dynamo who would become one of the most powerful leaders and symbols of the Southern Civil Rights Movement. She always spoke of her Mississippi appendectomy as the galvanizing force that propelled her into a national leadership role. And she always spoke regretfully of the children she would never have. She was a lifelong opponent of birth control. Evolutionary laggards. The 20th century saw the dawn of the medical philosophy eugenics, derived from the Greek word eugenes, meaning well-born. The word was coined by Francis Galton, a cousin of Charles Darwin. Between 1900 and 1910, geneticists discovered human traits that adhere to a Mendelian pattern of inheritance, one in which the breeding of two carrier parents resulted in a mathematically predictable mixture of well, ill, and carrier offspring. Several metabolic conditions were among these Mendelian discoveries, including sickle cell anemia, red-green color blindness, and polydactyly, having more than the normal number of fingers or toes. The birth of an affected child from unaffected parents signaled that the parents were carriers. Armed with this knowledge, Galton first formulated the desirability of using selective procreation to refine the human race while conquering social dysfunction. This goal was widely embraced on both scientific and popular levels by the 1930s, not only in the United States, but also abroad, and eugenic yardsticks were applied to not only populations, but to individuals. Eugenicists propose that society use medical information about disease and trait inheritance to end social ills by encouraging the birth of children with good, healthy, and beautiful traits. This was positive eugenics. But the movement also had a negative face. Eugenicists promulgated the weeding out of undesirable societal elements by discouraging or preventing the birth of children with bad genetic profiles. The term well-born has a double meaning of born healthy and born wealthy, and this is fitting because eugenic scientists and their disciples constantly confused the concepts of biological hereditary fitness with those of class and race. Highly educated persons of good social class were considered eugenically superior. The poor, the uneducated, criminals, recent immigrants, blacks, and the feeble-minded were eugenic misfits. Eugenicists invoked the term racial hygiene as frequently as they did the word eugenics, and even a cursory glance at the charts, photographs, and diagrams used to popularize eugenic ideals reveals that the unfit were swarthy, black, and ugly by Anglo-Saxon standards, with flattened noses, wiry black hair, and prognathous profiles. African Americans were roundly disparaged by eugenic theory as scientists continued to seek and find wide physiological evidence of black inferiority. In a refinement of earlier scientific racism, eugenics was appropriated to label black women as sexually indiscriminate and as bad mothers who were constrained by biology to give birth to defective children. The demonization of black parents, particularly mothers, as medically and behaviorally unfit, has a long history. But 20th century eugenicists provided the necessary biological underpinnings to scientifically validate these beliefs. The sexual irrepressibility and the bad mothering were biologically located in the hereditary apparatus, they contended. Thus, eugenics undergirded medico-social movements that placed the sexual behavior and reproduction of blacks under strict scrutiny and disproportionately forced them into sterility, both temporary and permanent. Scientists also vigorously researched black fertility, compiling data on black birth rates and using women of color predominantly to test many reproductive technologies and strategies, from involuntary sterilization to Norplant, to the shot. In 1915, Dr. Harry J. Heiselden heralded the first wave of U.S. eugenics when he gained fame and wealth by exploiting the evil legacy of the black mother. Heiselden was as famous in his time as Dr. Jack Kevorkian was in our own, and for an eerily similar reason. Both hastened the death of those they perceived as unfit for life, and both chose their victims from the poles of life. Kevorkian preyed upon the old or ill, Heiselden on sick, defective infants. On November 12, 1915, he announced to newspapers that he had allowed the ailing but viable newborn of his patient, Anna Bollinger, to die in Chicago's German-American hospital because he would have gone through life as a defective. Between 1915 and 1918, Heiselden killed five other babies, drawing fawning attention from the press each time. Practicing negative eugenics very publicly, Heiselden encouraged parents and other pediatricians to follow his example by killing or allowing the deaths of the genetically inferior. Parents began openly to recruit doctors to kill their children who were born with birth defects, and doctors came forward with their own proud confessions of infanticide. Like Kevorkian, Heiselden arranged photo ops with his dying patients and their mothers. When he decided to make a film to popularize his eugenic ideals, starring himself, it became a hit, making him a wealthy movie star. That film was The Black Stork. It begins with the story of a white, wealthy, well-born slave owner who, in a moment of inebriation, is seduced by his vile, filthy black servant. The resulting child supplies a genetic taint to his family that haunts his progeny, making them unfit to marry. One scene showcases a panoply of defective children, and the very first image is that of a black child. In titling the film, Heiselden was mindful of both the negative and the racial connotations of the word black. Martin Pernick, Ph.D., the premier expert on Heiselden and his work, points out that Heiselden repeatedly equated black with ugliness and undesirability. The fact that her white master, but not she, must be addled by drink before they have sexual congress speaks to the black woman's innate shamelessness. At the film's end, the tainted descendant of the union is subjected to euthanasia, with the approval of a berobed Jesus who stands over the cradle. This ham-handed bit of eugenic propaganda buoyed popular sentiment toward eugenics. Soon, life began to imitate Heiselden's art. German doctors became obsessed with regaining an imaginary Nordic purity even before the 1933 rise of Hitler and National Socialism. But U.S. national eugenics policies had employed unconscionable medical violations against those they considered unfit, including blacks, since 1910. The lions of American and German eugenics were united not only by a shared vision of racial purity, but also by the International Society for Racial Hygiene. Chief among its American members was mathematician and biologist Charles Davenport, Ph.D., who established the Station for Experiment Evolution, SEE, and in 1910, the privately funded and seminal Eugenics Record Office, ERO, at Cold Spring Harbor on Long Island, New York, which joined with SEE in 1920 under the aegis of the Carnegie Institute. Davenport was fascinated by biometrics, the quantitative study of evolution. Under him, the ERO conducted research on human heredity by means of numerically mapping human traits, collecting large amounts of eugenic data from scientists and physicians who shared their patients' family and medical histories. The ERO also informed popular and legal opinion concerning eugenics, as when Davenport's deputy, Harry Hamilton Laughlin, provided the extensive statistical research that proved essential to the National Origins Act of 1924. It barred immigrants from southern and eastern European countries as dysgenic. The ERO was so indispensable to the prestige of eugenic science that when Carnegie withdrew its funding support on December 31, 1939, its closing marked the official end of the eugenics era. Laughlin, who was also head of the SEE, worried in print that no two races had ever maintained their purity while living in as close proximity as U.S. blacks and whites did. In 1910, he published a research study of the skin colors that resulted from black-white matings. Predictably, warm relations reigned between American eugenicists and the Germans, who shared Laughlin's abhorrence of black-white mating. In 1933, Davenport's Eugenical News praised the German race hygiene movement and published abstracts of articles from German eugenics journals such as Archiv für Rassen- und Gesellschaftsbiologie. Laughlin shared detailed information about eugenic sterilization in the United States with Eugen Fischer, director of Berlin's Kaiser Wilhelm Institut für Anthropologie, Menschliche, Erblehre und Eugenik, Institute for Anthropology, Human Genetics, and Eugenics. In gratitude, Heidelberg University awarded Laughlin an honorary Doctor of Medicine degree in 1936. Although their cruel acts of genocide were primarily directed against Jews and white Europeans, National Socialists also considered any admixture with people of African descent intolerable. For example, the Rhineland Bastard were the offspring, born during the 1920s, of German women and French Somalian soldiers who were stationed in the Rhineland during its post-World War I occupation. The Reichsbahnführer, Richard Walter Dare, declared, "As a Rhinelander, I demand sterilization for all mulattoes with whom we were saddled by the black shame on the Rhine." German hereditary health courts judged the reproductive fitness of poor and ill Gentiles on a case-by-case basis. But for blacks and Afro-Germans, visual or verbal evidence of African ancestry was enough to justify immediate secret sterilization in on-site clinics under Special Commission No. 3, which was devised by Eugen Fischer in 1937. For example, Frankfurt Health Office records for June 19, 1937, note, "The German citizen Joseph Fick, born on 26 September 1920 and residing in Mainz, is a descendant of the former colonial occupation troops, North Africa, and distinctly displays the corresponding anthropological characteristics. For that reason, he is to be sterilized. His mother consents to the sterilization." Upon demand, Afro-German men had to produce health documents certifying that they had been sterilized. And although the sterilization of at least 385 children is well documented, an entire generation of Afro-Germans was robbed of its fertility. However, Nazi eugenicists frequently observed that their laws to bar Jewish Aryan mating were more liberal than were American laws to separate people of African descent from the white genetic pool. Germans held that a person who was one-quarter Jewish was a legal Aryan and thus fit to marry a German. But parallel marriages and matings between whites and blacks were illegal in much of the United States, and, in effect, punishable by death, lynching. The one-drop laws of many southern states counted anyone who had even 1/32nd African heritage as black. Other laws, such as the 1924 Virginia Racial Integrity Act, denominated anyone with any Negro blood at all as black. Editors of German medical journals learned a great deal about eugenic prescription by studying American medical journals, whose charts precisely detailed which racial mixtures were tolerable in marriages to whites, who was white enough to vote, and so on. In fact, a cordial rivalry characterized the relationship between German and American eugenicists. "The Germans are beating us at our own game," Virginian eugenicist Dr. Joseph S. Dejarnet sighed in thinly veiled admiration during a 1934 speech in which he urged the Virginia legislature to expand its sterilization laws. However, eugenics initiatives, like much of the unethical racial experimentation in the United States, suffered from more than moral flaws. They were simply illogical. There are several reasons why any experiments in improving health and purifying racial stock by removing certain tainted individuals from populations will fail to root out the unwanted genes. But scientists had known of at least one since 1917. Before the advent of genetic screening tests, one had only classic Mendelian genetics to rely upon. And one could determine whether a person was a carrier of a genetic taint only by the health of his children. Too late for eugenic measures to prevent breeding. English geneticist P.C. Punnett had determined by 1917 that eugenic steps to prevent the reproduction of people exhibiting disease symptoms would fail to detect so many carriers they would be rendered useless. This knowledge made eugenic strategies and goals scientifically invalid as well as morally repugnant. The Negro Project. Margaret Sanger, born to a Corning, New York socialist in 1883, was the most famous American popularizer of eugenics, although she is usually lauded as a powerful birth control pioneer and as a feminist. All these labels fit. Her abundant writings, speeches, and myriad projects reveal a complex, passionate woman whose mission changed over time from women's rights advocacy to eugenics. Sanger shaped American reproductive policy by toppling the Comstock laws against contraceptive distribution, by catalyzing the development of the birth control pill, and by founding the organization that became Planned Parenthood, the nation's 12th largest charitable organization. But she did so in alliance with eugenicists, and through initiatives such as the Negro Project, Sanger exploited black stereotypes in order to reduce the fertility of African Americans. Sanger was a cautious speaker, so it is important to examine not only what she said, but what she did. In her 1922 eugenics tome, The Pivot of Civilization, she claimed, "Eugenics is chiefly valuable in its negative aspects. On its so-called positive or constructive side, it fails to awaken any permanent interest." In this book, Sanger popularized her research into the eugenic value of various types of Americans by offering up a slew of case histories. She published a dysgenic family case history to describe the eugenic problems black families presented. The parents of a feeble-minded girl, 20 years of age, who was committed to the Kansas State Industrial Farm on a vagrancy charge, lived in a thickly populated Negro district, which was reported by the police to be the headquarters for the criminal element of the surrounding state. Sanger tells us at great length and in detail that all of the girl's family died early or went on to lead lives of hyperfecundity, prostitution, violent crime, or all three. The Negro district itself, we are told, is the headquarters for the criminal element. So clearly, we are meant to take the black girl's dysfunctional family as representative. While Sanger's early campaigns were aimed primarily at Eastern Europeans, she turned her attention to blacks in 1929. That year, Lothrop Stoddard wrote his book, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, while serving on the board of directors of Sanger's American Birth Control League, ABCL, and Sanger's lover, Havelock Ellis, reviewed it favorably in her journal, Birth Control Review. That year, she also discarded labels such as good or bad breeding stock in favor of class or income level. As she began researching birth patterns in Harlem, where 224,760 of New York City's 330,000 African Americans lived, Sanger entitled the June 1932 Birth Control Review, The Negro Number, and she recruited black leaders to contribute articles in support of the eugenic cause. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's founder, W.E.B. Du Bois, wrote, and Sanger often quoted, "The mass of ignorant Negroes still breed carelessly and disastrously, so that the increase among Negroes, even more than the increase among whites, is from that portion of the population least intelligent and fit, and least able to rear their children properly." Charles S. Johnson, Fisk University's first black president, wrote that eugenic discrimination was necessary for blacks, and a dozen black writers agreed in print. In January 1939, Sanger's American Birth Control League merged with the Clinical Research Bureau to form the Birth Control Federation of America, BCFA. Later that year, Sanger devised the Negro Project, which was established for the benefit of the colored people, specifically black women who were being denied access to city health services. The first experimental family planning centers sought to find the best way of reducing the black population by promoting eugenic principles, and were also founded in black areas such as Macon County, Alabama, site of the notorious PHS syphilis study. Du Bois also suggested approaching black churches, declaring them open to intelligent propaganda of any sort, and added that her organization and other agencies ought to get their speakers before church congregations and their arguments in the Negro newspapers. Sanger took Du Bois' advice, writing, "The most successful educational approach to the Negro is through a religious appeal. We do not want the word to get out that we want to exterminate the Negro population, and the minister is the man who can straighten out that idea if it occurs to any of their more rebellious members." She recruited the support of such luminaries as Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., of the Abyssinian Baptist Church, and later, the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Sanger also wanted a black doctor and social worker to staff the clinic in order to gain black patients' trust. She assured the doubtful BCFA that the black physician's authority would be limited, and he, like the clinic board members, would be chosen for tractability. His work, in my opinion, should be entirely with the Negro profession and the nurses, hospital, social workers, as well as the county's white doctors. His success will depend upon his personality and his training by us. When the black Harlem Clinic personnel eventually protested their lack of autonomy, the BCFA withdrew support and the clinic closed. But Sanger's experiment of addressing black social ills with the application of negative eugenics via black birth control clinics was so successful that it persists today. Sanger left another important legacy. She supported the development of the birth control pill. Waves of social and political transformation roiled the 1960s and 1970s. But some of the most lasting revolutions were triggered by a single medical event, the development of the pill. It placed cheap, easy contraception within every woman's grasp for the first time, with an ideal laboratory rate of 98% effectiveness. The women's movement was galvanized by the sudden ability to reliably uncouple sex from procreation. So was the sexual revolution. The birth control pill was developed during an era in which abortion was still illegal, but laws prohibiting contraceptive use also remained in effect until the 1960s, and the distribution of information about contraception was not legalized until 1971. Legal spermicidal creams and jellies were expensive, hard to obtain, and unreliable. So were the back alley abortions, from which thousands of women died horribly. The pill was made available to poor black women free or cheaply from government-sponsored Planned Parenthood clinics in central urban areas, facilities that were the direct progeny of Sanger's Negro Project clinics. Clinics had many other contraceptive technologies in their arsenals, including condoms and diaphragms, barrier methods that physically blocked access of semen to the uterine neck, backed up by spermicidal jellies and creams. Clinics also fitted more African-American women than white women with intrauterine devices, or IUDs. But a history of forcible sterilization fed suspicions that the federally financed birth control clinics in their neighborhoods were attempts to discover the best way to limit or even to erase the black presence in America. Florida NAACP Director Marvin Davies argued that blacks needed to produce as many babies as possible until blacks constituted 30 to 35% of Americans. In 1962, the National Urban League rescinded its support of contraception, and so did many local NAACP chapters. 28% of the blacks surveyed in the late 1960s agreed that encouraging blacks to use birth control is comparable to trying to eliminate this group from society. These genocidal fears were dismissed as paranoia, but prominent white physicians had long advocated a reduction in black births as a means of pinching off the race. In 1903, for example, politically influential physician Charles S. Bacon, M.D., advocated that the Black Belt will be defined by the government as a Negro reservation similar to Indian reservations. The plan that has worked so well in its treatment of the Indian question until it has practically eliminated the question with the race. The 1967 Black Power Conference in Newark, New Jersey, passed a resolution that equated birth control with black genocide. And that year, a crowd of blacks chanted, "Genocide!" as they burned down a Cleveland, Ohio contraceptive clinic. Those who cried genocide found support in a United Nations resolution. On December 9, 1948, in reaction to the Nazi-engineered European Holocaust, the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide unanimously passed a genocide provision, prescribing any attempt to destroy a racial or religious group by killing or harming its members. Resolution 260-3A of the United Nations General Assembly of 1948 states in part, "Genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. As such, A. Killing members of the group. B. Causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part." The document also prohibited D. imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, and E. forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Many blacks argue that the birth control movement per se constitutes genocide under Article D because its negative eugenic stance has consistently targeted blacks. By 1972, the American Journal of Public Health verified that the load of genocidal fears had widened. 40% of surveyed blacks now believed birth control clinics were a ploy to eradicate blacks, and these respondents expressed a deep distrust of sterilization programs, abortion clinics, and any birth control programs run by whites. However, a strong gender divide prevailed. Men were much more likely to denounce birth control as genocide than women, especially young, less well-educated, poor, and northern men. In contrast, most black women embraced birth control and more women than men countenanced abortion. In 1970, social activist Donald Bogue found that 80% of the black women he surveyed in Chicago approved of birth control, and 75% were using it. Unlike Fannie Lou Hamer, many black women of the post-pill generation had career options, thanks to the racial integration of schools and workplaces. Women were eager to leave unskilled labor behind and to enter the professional sphere, so they wished to delay the responsibilities of motherhood until they were ready. But many black women who desired and used birth control did so despite a strong distrust of the whites who distributed contraception in their communities. In 1972, black social worker Aurelia Brown voiced this ambiguity. "Negroes don't want children they can't take care of, but we are afraid to trust you when your offered help has so often turned out to be exploitation." Black Chicago activist Lonnie Myers confessed her discomfort with the fact that some birth control funding came from those racists who simply wished to decrease the number of blacks in the city. But she noted that any cause has strange bedfellows. Blacks also drew a distinction between physician-controlled methods and those they could control themselves. 87% of surveyed blacks said they approved of public contraceptive clinics, while 47% rejected sterilization. Considering these social complexities, is the term genocide an accurate description of the birth control initiatives directed at African Americans? The proliferation of birth control clinics that were clearly aimed at an African American population falls neatly within the UN definitions. They were intended to selectively reduce births within the group. Also, these clinics were numerous and well-funded at a time when health advocates failed to address more pressing African-American health issues, such as abysmal nutrition, poor control of infectious disease, high infant mortality, low life expectancy, poor quality health care, scarce mental health care, and even a lack of access to hospitals and physicians. This medical myopia cripples any argument that birth control clinics were erected with the health of African Americans in mind. But although the proliferation of birth control clinics was unethical, the general rise of reproductive clinics in black neighborhoods did not constitute genocide, because, whatever the intent of the whites who introduced them, such measures were widely embraced by black women. They welcomed a contraceptive choice, however warily they eyed those who offered it. But as we will soon see, some contraceptive initiatives did richly earn the genocide label. After the first giddy honeymoon, women and their doctors realized that the pill's high levels of hormones were harmful. It was dangerous for women who smoked, and it inflated hypertension and stroke risks, serious flaws for African Americans, who are especially vulnerable to both conditions. Moreover, forgotten and late pills lowered the contraceptive's real-world effectiveness rate to only 70-80%. The same vulnerability haunted most other popular birth control methods, except one, the intrauterine device, or IUD, a favorite with the birth control clinics that served inner-city women. The IUD had many forms, but was essentially a small, thin and oddly shaped wire coil that a doctor inserted into the uterus, where it prevented pregnancy until the physician removed it. The IUD proved disastrous for African Americans. Initially, researchers were not sure how it worked, but after several years, they speculated that it continually irritated the uterine lining, creating an inhospitable environment that prevented the implantation of a fertilized egg. This discovery enraged many black women because it seemed like murdering an unborn child. Also, black women are particularly vulnerable to uterine conditions such as fibroids, endometriosis, and cancer, making constant irritation of the uterus seem ill-advised. Finally, the IUD was unmasked as a killer. It became associated with deadly infections that hampered or destroyed users' fertility. Later, scientists determined that the braided string descending from the wire of the Dalkon Shield IUD provided a breeding ground for dangerous bacteria. Most IUDs were taken off the market by the 1980s. Because Dalkon Shields were primarily dispensed in inner-city clinics, some activists charged that Black women had been targeted to test a form of birth control known to cause sterility. However, this is unlikely. Scientists clearly hoped that the devices would work well, not fail. But researchers did not introduce racial bias by overwhelmingly apportioning the potential health risks of experimental birth control technologies to women of color, including Black American women. The pill, Norplant, and the Depo Provera shot were first tested in Mexico, Africa, Brazil, Puerto Rico, and India. Once approved, they were administered to large numbers of girls and women in U.S. venues that are disproportionately, and usually overwhelmingly, African American and Hispanic. These include urban Planned Parenthood clinics, school-based clinics, and urban health clinics that serve Medicaid patients. Many serious effects emerge for the first time during this post-approval stage, when very large numbers of women begin taking a drug. Thus, the immediately post-approval use of contraceptive methods in large numbers of closely monitored poor women of color constituted a final testing arm, so that they were unwittingly participating in a research study. At this stage, serious health complications emerged with methods such as the IUD, Norplant, and the shot, before they ever gained popularity with middle or upper-class white women who are cared for by private physicians. In patterns too consistent to be accidental, reproductive drug testing makes poor women of color, at home and abroad, bear the brunt of any health risks that emerge.
And we will stop there. We will pick up next week. We are in the middle of Chapter 8, the Mississippi Appendectomy is the subheading we'll start at for next Friday. If you would like to chime in, please do not wait until the last minute. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. I hope people, if you have the book, you should get the book, number one, you should have this in your library, but two, you should check the footnotes as we are reading, or once you get the book or what have you, check the references, because there are a lot of other great books that you might want to check out, articles, books, newspaper reports and what have you, and sometimes just notes from Miss Washington herself. With that, we will check in with the people who did not get to comment at all to see if they have anything they would like to share, and then we will get other folks who are on the line as well. The caller at 9516, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I just wanted to make a comment to one of the callers. He was saying that, the nurse ever gets a pass, and I was just thinking, of course she gets a pass. You know, we all get a pass because we are all victims of racism. And when they were talking about Planned Parenthood being started, that it was funded by racists, I just remember listening to an audio, I think on YouTube some time ago, and racists were calling in to donate, and they were specifically asking about, you know, where their dollars were going, specifically wanted to make sure that their money would be going towards Black women's abortion. And that's all. Thank you.
For sure. I think that portion of that audio was in Ma'afa 21. We had the white filmmaker as a guest on the program to discuss some of that, because, yeah, that's a whole other commentary. I think some of that is in the film Ma'afa 21, which is about, but it is, it is done deliberately as a piece of film that is anti-abortion, the white people who put that project together. The retired firefighter in Florida, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yes, in reference to the nurse, there are some consequences of a person in her position would have had to suffer, known and unknown. It's because it happened many times in many similarities of a black person that's involved in some sort of way with our collective mistreatment. That particular non-white black person was just like the people who directly were being mistreated, was right in the line of being terrorized themselves, similar to the situation whereas in prison, if they're having someone beating up people in prison, that's a black person, more than likely be other black people doing it. It's a similar situation that, okay, if you don't do the beating, then we're going to deal with you directly. So, you know, and the same thing happened during slavery also, as far as that concerned. And I think she was kind of like terrorized up in that way. She gets a pass in my mind. I don't like to use that word, she gets a pass, but that's the only thing I can think of right now. Fannie Lou Hamer has to be, in my mind, one of the most courageous people that ever lived in my mind. I was aware of how she was medically butchered and very, very, as I mentioned, very courageous person. We all know about the famous speech that she made during the Democratic convention, which was, it was so striking that the president at that time cut her off national television because what she was saying was so powerful at the time, as far as her testimony on the terror that was going on in Ruville, Mississippi, and in that part of the world called the Deep South. Margaret Sanger, she is like, you look up white woman in the dictionary, her face should be the picture. Can go anywhere, maneuver, circulate in any vestige where non-white black people are at, similar to the evil Mrs. Clinton, and could make people relax to whereas she spies through her spying, is able to deceive, therefore mistreat, and ultimately terrorize non-white people all over the world. She goes right up there in my mind with Adolf Hitler and whoever else, you know, you want to be on that list as far as white people in general, actually. But she is well up there as far as from a scientifically evil person all around. And the book just brings that out a little bit more from a medical standpoint. And just a note, in my personal family, my mother's side, I had, because both of them are deceased, two aunts, which is my mother's family's first two females, and they never were able to have children of their own. They were married for very long periods of time, both of them, till their husband's death, but they never had children. I think it is a quite common occurrence that took place, and I never did know exactly what was the story behind the two, but I'm pretty sure something similar to what we are reading in this book took place with those two ladies. because of the terror that was especially going on at that time. It was a place that's called Cordell, Georgia, which is also the place where the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, his birthplace was. But anyway, that's all I have to say. It's as far as the book is concerned today. Thank you.
Caller at 4231. 4231, did you have commentary you wanted to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to... Excuse that. Can I be heard clearly now?
Oh, yes, sir. Did you get to speak during the first audio segment?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I think...
Appreciate the opportunity.
For sure. I just want to make sure we didn't miss anybody. Is anybody who hasn't been able to share at all today? I think we got everybody who wasn't able to share yet. So is there anybody that we missed completely? Just making sure I didn't miss anyone. I thought we got them all. Go ahead, sir. Thank you for being patient. 4231.
Oh, okay. I just want to say that I'm not surprised at the information that was revealed about the existence of the system of racism, white supremacy, sophisticated terrorism. And I noticed also that the loophole in what they say the United Nations stood for in the area of law or politics, etc., was they said something about, you know, just trying to destroy or genocide your people as a race or your genetics or whatever. And then they also stated the word religion. And so, you know, all of this can be used as a weapon against you or a weapon for you. And so that's why I think the atmosphere that we see today, as far as the same treatment where you see these medicines come out and then the next couple of days you see a commercial about it, and it's, you know, basically a racist white supremacist can pay $2.2 billion to do a basic experiment on a bunch of people during the existence of racism, white supremacy, and the accountants have valued that at $2.2 billion, and that's disgusting. But that's all I wanted to add.
Other folks that haven't been able to comment during the second, after the second audio segment, people that had a hand up, you should be with us. If you had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Gus. I just wanted to chime in first, starting off with Fannie Lou Hamer. She is one of the major heroines of my life, and her life story is very indicative of the fact that once any person who is black enters the white medical establishment, and I call it dedical because all they're dedicated to is killing you, so there's nothing medical about it. But once you enter that system, that literally anything can happen to you. A lot of times when I go to the doctor, I go there to find out what the symptoms are, whatever the situation is, and then I try to handle it myself using natural means. I try not to use their medication unless it's absolutely necessary and try to research it before I touch it. Otherwise, I don't take it at all. And I just believe that it's still happening to this day where our people are going into these hospital establishments believing that they're being treated for one specific ailment, and they're either removing things that they shouldn't remove or in some form or fashion experimenting on us. And we have to really, really, like, this book is really bringing it home in a way that is extremely profound as far as just shifting my consciousness as far as how I deal with the medical system. One of the other things I wanted to touch on was on page 194, where it says, upon demand, Afro-German men had to produce health documents certifying that they had been sterilized, and although the sterilization of at least 385 children is well documented, an entire generation of Afro-Germans was robbed of its fertility. And it's very interesting because I have a documentary on the sterilization of Afro-Germans, and there was a black male who actually went through that they interviewed, and he talked about being woken up in the early morning hours when he turned, about a week before he turned 16 years old. He was 15 at the time, if I'm not mistaken. And they came to his house with his where he lived with his mother. They actually took him to a facility, and without anesthesia, they cut off his testicles. So this stuff that was being done to these German Africans were essentially was done without anesthesia. So again, they're castrating these people as children, and they're not getting any sort of anesthesia, and they're being forced to do so. So a lot of times what Germans did to Jews, they perfected on African people first, and I believe that that is one of the great things that they had accomplished. Also, on page 197, there's a section that reads, Charles S. Johnson, Fisk University's first black president, wrote that eugenic discrimination was necessary for blacks, and a dozen writers agreed in print. In January 1939, Sanger's American Birth Control League merged with the Clinical Research Bureau to form the Birth Control Federation of America. Later that year, Sanger devised the Negro Project, which was established for the benefit of the colored people, specifically black women who were being denied access to city health services. These first experimental family planning centers sought to find the best way of reducing the black population by promoting eugenic principles, and were also founded in black areas such as Macon County, Alabama, site of the notorious PHS syphilis study. Du Bois also suggested approaching black churches, declaring them open to intelligent propaganda of any sort, and adding that her organization and other agencies ought to get their speakers before church congregations and their arguments in the Negro newspapers. It's just this really kind of this section just to me really brings home what blind faith and what white people are doing. How destructive that can be, because they were able to get very powerful black people like Du Bois and Charles Johnson to back their planning to destroy black life. And again, I don't think they were really understanding the fact that this was about genocide, and they were buying into this whole premise thinking that, okay, well, white people are doing it to their own kind, so I guess the same rules must apply to us. And we really have to start looking at the types of things that white people present to us and understand that no matter how seemingly positive they are, they will always be destructive and to the benefit of white supremacy, not anything beneficial to black people. Anything that we have ever obtained from them, whether it's cultural, psychosocial, or actual, has always been destructive for us. And again, it just shows that even some of the best prominent minds, black minds, also have been so infused with trust for white people that we're able to literally facilitate their destruction of our own people, as I think that paragraph elucidates. On page 199, there's a section that talks about the meaning of genocide. It says, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. As such, A, killing members of the group. B, causing serious bodily and mental harm to members of the group. C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. The document also prohibited D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. And E, forcible transferring of children of the group to another group. I find this to be extremely telling because all of these things are still happening to our people. When they talk about the forcible transferring of children of the group to another group, that's what's happening in the so-called adoption, which I call the abduction system, in which they're giving our black children to these anti-sexual white people and allowing them to be raped and indoctrinated into sexual white supremacy via these white people. And all of the other sections of the meaning of this term genocide is exactly what we've been dealing with ever since our first contact with white people, and we really need to study that section that she wrote. And if we are able to look at it for what it is and understand her positioning on that, I think it should really help raise the consciousness of the black people who read this book to understand the dangers of what white people present to us. And the last section I wanted to touch on was on page 200. And it says at the bottom of the page, considering these social complexities, the term genocide is an accurate description of the birth control initiatives directed at Considering these social complexities, is the term genocide an accurate description of the birth control initiatives directed at African Americans, the proliferation of birth control clinics that were clearly aimed at an African American population falls neatly within the U.S. definition. They were intended to selectively reduce births within the group. Also, these clinics were numerous and well-funded at a time when health advocates failed to address more pressing African American health issues, such as abysmal nutrition, poor control of infectious disease, high infant mortality, low life expectancy, poor quality health care, scarce mental health care, and even a lack of access to hospitals and physicians. This medical myopia cripples any argument that birth control clinics were erected with the health of African Americans in mind. And again, this really speaks to even birth control. I remember my mother had an IUD inserted back in the 80s, and she had such horrible uterine complications. Eventually, she developed fibroids, and she almost died multiple times due to excessive bleeding. So I really wanted to thank the sister who talked about how she cured herself using ginger tea. That's stuff that I definitely have passed on to my mom. And just the fact that these things, again, we were partaking of things like IUDs and these birth control pills, assuming that these white people had our best interest and it was all about genocide. And we really just need to mistrust and suspect every last white person we ever encounter of being racist white supremacists. In my opinion, there's not one that is not. All of them are racist white supremacists. But for those who don't view things that way, racist suspects at minimum. Thank you for taking my call, guys.
For sure. Anybody else that we have not heard from? Did you have commentary? Other folks
here?
Mr. Demi-4, you want to try again? You were a little low the first time. You want to try again?
Okay. Okay. Can I be heard?
Yeah,
first,
yes,
I want
sir.
To give kudos to Ms. Fannie Mae Hammer. She was a courageous person, and, you know, her name should always be put out there. It's like Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. said, when you choose to fight against racism, you know, that's what you'll be known by. And surely she'll be remembered as a courageous soldier in civil rights. But the population control, you know, has always been one of the strategies of the racist white supremacists, because if you consider that they are a tiny minority globally, then it would be necessary for them to attempt to control population and dilute bloodlines as much as possible, cause confusion, and then that would lead to basically them classifying themselves only as white and deserving of all this righteous treatment, and everybody else non-white. Margaret Sanger, you know, she's should be up there with, you know, one of these vile racists that has got the memorials all over the nation, racists who have perpetrated death and destruction upon black people. You know, she's up there with the best of them. And, you know, how they collaborated with the Germans. It was even rumored that Hitler got the idea from America. And genocide was an accurate word. And I thought when Fannie Lou Hammer used the Mississippi appendectomy, you know, where it would behoove everybody, you could go in for a simple procedure and end up coming out with some of your body, the organs, missing. That, you know, she covered quite a bit, all this birth control, you know, and how it deceived, you know, people of that time, and even started the sexual revolution, you know, and some of those devices and even the chemicals that they used may have contributed to high levels of breast cancer, and it could be you know, passing toxins, you know, through the generations. We don't know. But we have to be careful. And with that, I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call.
Sorry about that. Yes, sir, we can hear you, Thomas, in New York.
Oh, I'm sorry, Gus. Just wanted to say, man, the first reading, all that kept ringing in my head was AIDS. And then after reading the second part, that really rung, you know, it was like the force of them to use birth control. Let's figure out a way that we're going to force them to use it, you know. How about some diseases, you know? I mean, just very proficient. And, you know, I give Nurse Rivers a pass, but I don't know. I'm not too sure about W.B. Floyd, S.C. Johnson for signing on with those eugenics. Very negative views of black people. I just felt like that was a lot of anti-blackness, and they're very well revered, and I guess that's why. I just amazed that how it seems like Hitler's whole ideology came straight from the United States, you know, that was right, recorded right over there. The anti-blackness, number one input, the export of white supremacy, recorded right over there in the form of they formed the science out of it called the eugenics. And it's amazing. I mean, and they even had their own little system over there. You know, if you had one quarter, it was something with the Jews, if they could marry a white woman, they had to have, I think, three-fourths Aryan or something like that. Just totally learning a lot, and I meet my line. Thank you.
For sure. The caller at 8043, did you have a commentary you wanted to add?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Let me first say that I am a registered nurse. My specialty is women's health. And so what we covered in medical apartheid is very near and dear to me. I am of the opinion that the womb of the woman is the most powerful institution on the face of this earth. The reason I'm of that opinion is because everyone has to pass through the womb in order to get here. And so when there is control over this bodily organ, then there's full control. Thing that I have a lot of concern with that I'm seeing increasing is the amount of cesarean sections that are being done. Many times it is being done for convenience and not necessarily as an emergency. And a couple of reasons it's my concern. The ideal way for an infant to come or a newborn to come to the earth is coming through the vaginal process. There are a number of physiological, anatomical things that happen when an infant passes through that way that is ideal. And I won't go into that in terms of the times that's involved. Also, physicians make more money off of cesarean sections. But my main concern is that when a woman has one cesarean section, 9 times out of 10, her future births will be by cesarean section. And a body can only take a certain number of cesarean sections before the woman moves into danger with pregnancy. So cesarean sections limit the number of children that a woman can have. The second thing that's of concern is before a baby leaves the hospital, they are giving the baby a vaccination called the hepatitis B. This is a vaccination. It takes 3 vaccinations in order for it to come into effect, so we are told. So they start the first one before the baby even leaves the hospital. It's usually on the first or second day of birth. This is a disease that's only transmitted through exchange of bodily fluids or sexually. So there's really no reason to give the infant this vaccination before they leave the hospital. The other thing is I remember attending a lecture by Dr. Frances Welsing, and I asked her what she thought about vaccinations, and she responded to me with two words, biological warfare. The last thing that I'd like to remind, if it hasn't already been mentioned, is that Hillary Clinton received the Margaret Sanger Award. And when she received it, she talked about her admiration for this individual who was based on a lot of wickedness toward our people. And I will mute my line.
The caller at 2456, 2456, did you have commentary?
Yes, I did. Now, if we're going to go back, I just want to go back here, the end, excuse me, says, however, this is unlikely. Scientists clearly hope that the devices will work well, not fail. Talking about that IUD, but if you read up here, I mean, it prevented the implantation of a fertilized egg. This is what they were trying to do. And at the end, you're going to sit here and try to convince me that it was unlikely that they did this on purpose? This was purposely done. I'm upset about that. It was purposely done. I'm glad they went over the genocide and the definition of genocide. This is what Dr. Welsing warned of. We're on the genocide watch. Yes, that's a, when they read that, I was like, yes, that is black people. And there was a couple more in here. I just went on a highlight frenzy. They talked about how Martin Luther King was supposed to have been in on it. It was a lot of stuff here, but we know who's to blame for that, so we can't really be bringing people in. But they did highlight that it was Martin Luther King and somebody else. They got in and wrangled them in to say, yes, this is what we need to do as far as black people, because it's just getting out of control. It's horrible. It's horrible. And those are my comments. Thank you.
For sure. Anybody we missed, didn't get an opportunity to share? Assuming folks are straight, anybody that we missed, didn't get a chance? All righty. Some of the quick comments that I had, I guess number one, if you want to do further reading, you can download Margaret Sanger's work. It is The Pivot of Civilization. Margaret Sanger, you can download it for free. University of Pennsylvania has made it available. If you need the link or what have you, let me know. I can post it or email it or whatever the case may be. I downloaded it as we were listening. Also, the portion where they were talking about the Rhineland bastards and the mandatory forced sterilization of these black people that were in Germany. We talked about that extensively. Raphael Scheck, he wrote the book Hitler's African Victims. He talks about that extensively. He was on the program back in the spring of 2010. That's also in Ma'afa 21, the sterilization of these black people in Germany. And we had the filmmaker on the program in 2009, if you want to get more details about that. Some of the things that I highlighted, I thought when she began the chapter with Fannie Lou Hamer and her forced sterilization being butchered, I thought that that was grim. Where just the section where it says where she said, I went to the doctor who did that to me, and I asked him why had he done that to me. He didn't have to say nothing, and he didn't. He was going to give. if he was going to give that sort of operation, then he should have told me. I would have loved to have had children, but a lawsuit was out of the question. Hamer recalled, at that time, me getting a white lawyer against a white doctor, I would have been taking my hands and screwing tax in my casket. That I put that with Nurse Rivers and really any other black person under the system of racism, white supremacy. That is about the size of it. Direct quote from Fannie Lou Hamer. Extraordinary. Moving forward, a lot of the information about eugenics, we talked about a lot on the program. I was also reminded a lot of Dorothy Roberts, her first book when she was on the program in 2009, Killing the Black Body. Dorothy Roberts has already been quoted in this book a few times, and I am sure she's going to pop up in here because we talked about a lot of what was in the first part of Chapter 8 with these IUDs and Norplan and specifically targeting black people, Margaret Sanger, eugenics. That's almost the entire book of Killing the Black Body. That's what it's about. The portion where she talks about the film The Black Stork that was made in the early 20th century, the use of white Jesus Christianity at the film's end. The tainted descendant of the Union is subjected to euthanasia with the approval of a berobed white Jesus who stands over the cradle. This ham-handed bit of eugenic propaganda buoyed popular sentiment toward eugenics, strategic use of white Jesus, the religion of white supremacy. Yeah, the recruitment of black leaders. I can only emphasize the reason that I on this program say being less confused. I know myself that there were times, even yesterday in some respects, where I did not have the understanding of racism, white supremacy that I have today. And I think white people, as I've said consistently, they are the experts. Even the black people that we think and are told are experts on racism, they don't know as much about this system as the racists themselves do, and they are able to strategically exploit. I think Dr. Kamban says that is our disadvantage, where we don't have as much information about racism as they do, where we do not understand what it means to be white and think that there are some good whites that are out to help us and come offering us whatever it might be that is going to be, we think, of some benefit to black people, non-white people on the whole, just not understanding racism, what it means to be white. That in and of itself is a major part of our victimization that racists exploit all the time. I think that's something that's hugely important to keep in mind. And just one of the reasons, again, why I consistently say it is I am a little bit less confused. That way I'm not thinking that this is a smart, informed black person about racism, so they should know better in terms of what they're doing and how they're operating, how they interact with another white person. A lot of that's still going to come down to what your understanding of racism is, what your understanding of white folks is. Again, as I said, you can download if you want to read about Sanger's Negro Project and all that. You can just get her book and read that directly. Religion popped up again in skillful employment of black religious figures to work and go out and disseminate their information. I did think it was significant where she says, she assured the Birth Control Federation of America, the BCFA, that the Black Physicians Authority would be limited and he, like the clinic board members, would be chosen for tractability. That means our ability to control and manage them. If they're going to be stubborn and asking us a lot of questions, we won't pick them. We'll get somebody that'll be easier for us to manipulate and abuse for our racist agenda. I thought that was an extremely important portion as well. The great portion, even though there hasn't been a lot of that in this book, when she says, this is a little bit later, shout to Thomas in New York and New Jersey, where she says later in the book, at the 1967 Black Power Conference in Newark, New Jersey, passed a resolution that equated birth control with black genocide, and that year a crowd of blacks chanted genocide as they burned down a Cleveland, Ohio contraceptive clinic. That does not sound like lame black cowardice and chumps. I've said that consistently, that anytime anyone says that's the problem, that black people have not fought against racism, your speaking privileges should be immediately revoked. You should stop silence yourself and do more research. There are more illustrations of black people doing all kinds of things to fight against racism than you can possibly imagine. That has just been skillfully and deliberately hidden from us. I thought it was great her inclusion of specific definition for genocide and how it accurately applies to what has been continues to be done to black people. As I said, the information about NORPLANT, the IUDs, Dorothy Roberts talked about that in fantastic detail 2009 when she was on the program Killing a Black Body. And I agree. My final comment, again, cutting whites some slack. It can never be assumed that anything that happens that works out bad for black people, just automatically we should be taking the position that that was done deliberately and purposely. If the devices worked well, talking about these IUDs, they worked well because of the harm that they caused to black people, that that was intended. I think that's the logical counter-racist view we should take with anything that happens that has a disastrous, harmful result for black people. That would be for the IUDs, the Flint water situation, anything, as long as white supremacy exists. And I will stop there. If folks have questions, if you're listening to the archives and you want to write commentary, an email, or what have you to share down the road, we have about 6 sessions left. Again, we're at the halfway point this week, and we'll read it down the road. If you have questions, if you have problems, if you can't find a particular reference or what have you, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. And I found that article that NPR reported about how rare it is today, 2016, to have a female's name listed first on any sort of research study. Just keep that in mind. 1953, not 2000, 1953, to have Nurse Eunice Rivers' name first attached to the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment report. With that, we'll be here tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, the compensatory call-in. Looking forward to hearing from folks, workplace racism included. We will wrap. I will again encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of racism. I know it's a holiday weekend, but you still want to be codified. You never know. Enforcement officers, whites in general, civilian or otherwise, can make life very difficult for you. You do not want to make their job easier by being intoxicated where you cannot make great decisions to keep yourself safe. Buckle up, definitely, this weekend. You know they're going to have all kinds of sobriety checkpoints and what have you. Or maybe you don't know that, but they are probably going to have a lot of sobriety checkpoints and what have you out this weekend. So buckle up if you're going to be out and about. If you have children, definitely tell them 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times until they get tired of hearing it from you in terms of being codified this weekend. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.